Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, James Jones. With me today, Mr. John Lindemann.
It's good to be here, James.
It's good to have you, John. Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad that you're here as well. And Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
Hello, Greg.
Hello.
It's February 18th, 2016. Thursday. Again, they're always going to be Thursday unless we say otherwise, so I don't think I need to say that. And it's episode 464. We are finally getting around to our retroactive Unbeautiful Joe. But that will be after our first segment, which is, as always, as mostly, new business. And today I'm going to go ahead and have Greg lead us off. Greg, what are you going to play?
Before I go into what we've been playing, I'm going to just share the amusing thing that happened this week where we get a sort of downloads announcement a little in advance.
Monday
instead of Thursday, and then they come out on Thursday. And so the Monday announcement came through and there was virtually nothing on the Wii U side. It was just a demo and a release, I guess, of the latest Lego Avengers game, whatever. And immediately everybody's like, oh, smells like a direct, because that's happened in the past, where it's like, that's suspiciously light. I wonder if we're going to get something that announces some stuff, or at least a surprise download or something. But as of today, just nothing came out. It really was that bad.
If it makes you feel any better, we got three virtual console games.
Yeah, three. Mm-hmm. It's rare that we don't get any. This week for some reason there wasn't one. Unless there's going to be something, a surprise coming over the weekend or something to do with like the Zelda 30th anniversary or God knows whatever else. It looks like it was a red herring this time, so you can't use that as the sort of canary in the coal mine anymore.
Yeah, so we got two Ninja Gaiden games on the same day because, I don't know, whatever, and a Double Dragon game. So, yay, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's slim pickings. It's slim pickings. Actually, I think the only 3DS product we got besides demos was, and the retail games, obviously, was Music vs. Electronic Keyboard for $7.99.
Well, to be fair, as we're entering the RPG storm, though, I think it's all going to be kind of academic.
The RPG storm. That's what we're calling this phenomenon now.
We've been building it up for ages, and now that it's actually hitting, we've got to get into it. Of course, you get Fire Emblem Fates in its various incarnations over there. We won't be getting that, but we are getting Bravely Second next week. Well, like a few days from when this podcast will be published. And last week I played the demo. It's a demo that doesn't have limited uses because it's ostensibly kind of a bit of a prologue, even though narratively it has no sort of implications.
It's just there.
They did this last time for Bravely Default. I didn't play the demo that time, but I did this time for some reason. Even though I've got like a much better idea of what to expect this time, for some reason I fancy playing the demo, but, I wasn't on the show when I played Bravely Default, but we've kind of mentioned it here and there. But broadly speaking, I enjoyed it. I played it all the way to the end, even though there were some drawbacks associated with that. I am interested in the sequel. It's a bit of a conundrum because, as I said, we've got all these RPGs coming out, and quite a few of them have got good reputations. Some of them, in the case of Europe, are ones that you've had for a while, like Etrian Untold 2, for instance, but nonetheless, a very good reputation and all that. I'm kind of torn between Bravely Second, where I played the first one, so I know I've got a certain baseline of, like, I'll probably enjoy that. But on the other hand, trying something a little bit different. Because I know once I do, obviously we had Xenoblade a few months ago. So it's kind of early for me to be playing another RPG. I don't exactly chain them together like some people do.
Well, you're going to have to get used to it.
That's right. This is your only choice.
You're going into the eye of the storm, Greg. So, do your best, Jim Cantore, and let us know when you're actually in the eye of the RPG storm.
Well, there's a reference that will make sense to, a tiny sliver of our listener base. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
But
I will say that I feel the same way you do about a certain game called Project Cross Zone, but I know I won't enjoy it. So God pray for us.
Well, it's just one of these things, really. Like I said, I'm torn between something that I feel like I've got a pretty good baseline of knowledge with, that you know I'm going to enjoy it at least on some level. But you know, I mean, the reviews have just come in for Bravery Second, and you know, Dan, for instance, liked it quite a bit, but says like the story's like probably not as prominent in this one. But that's fine with me because it didn't really do that much for me in the last game. So it seems like what I did like about it is mostly present and correct, perhaps with the exception of the fact that there's new music, because they've got a different composer this time. And you know, playing the demo, that was kind of one of the things I actually wanted to see, although I've kind of heard some bits on YouTube as well. But yeah, I wanted to see what and there's some decent stuff in there. It seems like it'd be all right. But the first Bravely Default soundtrack was pretty special. I really, really like that. So it's kind of a shame that it's probably not going to quite live up to that. But visually, you know, it's much the same. You know, getting your nice big zooms when you leave yourself idling in the town for a little while and all that. And, you know, the same aesthetic, all that stuff. But there's a little bit of extra flair in certain places. Like, you know, I mean, there's a few kind of dungeon type environments that are going in the course of this prologue demo, and they actually have kind of some more different perspectives. Like when you're in a forest part, the camera is actually kind of lower to the ground, so it gives it a bit more of a feeling of, you know, like you're actually kind of in this dense forest or something, even though it's still, those parts are not the strongest sort of parts of the aesthetic, I guess. But you know, in the first Bravely Default, I just felt like, you know, it was really gorgeous, and then you got to the dungeons and it's like, oh yeah, I can tell this is sort of based on the Final Fantasy remakes on the, and Final Fantasy IV Warriors Alight, you know? It just, all of a sudden it became obvious, like, yeah, they're just very kind of, I don't know, utilitarian all of a sudden, the visuals in that. And with this, they're still similar, but it looks like at least there's going to be a bit more kind of artistry to them in those cases, with some of the camera angles and stuff like that. So that's nice. And the backgrounds when you're battling look pretty good. So, yeah, I think presentation's still going to be good. And, of course, I guess the weird thing with the gameplay components is, in some ways, we already got the enhancements for this game when we played the first one.
Right.
Because we played the localized version of For the Sequel, which was where they kind of took all the fan kind of feedback about the first one and just their own internal stuff and made improvements to the first game, re-released it ahead of working on the sequel, as kind of, I guess, you know, to test out how well it would go. And then that's the version we got. So it's kind of like, you know, I'm not sure how much you're really going to see, like, some really obvious improvements. But there were a couple of things in the demo. For instance, as before, you can access the random encounter rate. But now it's a lot easier to do it. It's just like on, you know, before that you actually had to press start, go through a menu or two to do it. Now, if you press the right shoulder button, you're bringing it up straight away and can modulate it on the fly a lot more. So I kind of like that, because, I mean, I had a general rule with the first one, which was when I'm exploring like a dungeon or something for the first time, you know, and you're sort of filling in the map on the lower screen and all that, I'll have the encounter rate on. After that, I made it kind of optional. And now I could probably get a little more granular with my switching. So I like that, because it's just, it's one of the things I do like about the game a lot, about the first game a lot, is how much you could kind of switch it up based on just what you're in the mood for, what your characters need to, you know, how you want to build up your characters at a given moment. But this, being able to access it so quickly kind of just puts that extra little convenience on it that I'll probably be a bit more nuanced about how I manage that than I was before. And then the other part of it that they've changed is the fact that you can sort of, if you could take out enemies in one shot, in one turn, which of course is a funny thing in Bravely Default, because you can essentially take multiple actions in one turn if you burn those points. You know, you bring forward your actions into, that's the whole Bravely Default system that I think works really well. But you know, if you kill all the enemies in one turn, well, then it'll give you the option to fight another lot of enemies, and then if you kill them in one turn, you'll get another lot and another lot, and it'll actually sort of build up this multiplier that'll be applied to the experience that you earn, the money, the job points. So I think, you know, that's a cool little angle there that, you know, if you go through certain areas where perhaps in the past you might have opted to switch the encounter rate off because perhaps those battles are just not going to really do anything for you. Now you've got a little more incentive to leave encounters on and, you know, maybe just, you know, experiment with different ways how to, you know, switch, how to be able to kill them all in one turn. And then the thing is that it sort of persists. So say, for instance, if you use one character, you burned all their action points in the first thing to kill them all in one turn. Well, then he's out of it for the next lot of enemies that come along. So, you know, to be able to actually sort of keep killing them all in one turn is going to get sort of increasingly tricky. So that seems like a nice little wrinkle as well.
And wasn't the World Ends With You, like, didn't that have the same kind of ability to chain up combat like that?
I believe so, yes. I mean, it was a while since we did the retroactive on that, but I seem to remember that kind of feature being in there. And I think it's something that people broadly enjoyed in that as well. So you add that to all the other kind of conveniences that this has got, and you know, I think it's really a great choice if you're interested in playing like a typical sort of classical JRPG. So yeah, I'm not sure, you know, about the story and the voice acting, because it is, you know, set in the same world as the first one. You know, this is not a Final Fantasy type of sequel. This is, well, I suppose it is a Final Fantasy type of sequel if we're talking like 10-2, or, you know, that kind
right.
of, you know, where they actually directly follow up the events of the previous game. It's in the same world and you've got some of the same characters and stuff. So, I mean, I wasn't a huge fan of that, but I know it didn't really like... It didn't torpedo the experience for me, so I could kind of tolerate it. And if it's less prominent, I think it's not going to be any kind of issue this time. So I'm leaning towards getting it next week when it comes out.
I mean, the only thing... So if you go back and listen to me talking about this game, the original game, Bravely Default, on RFN, you hear this slow spiral down of just... It starts out with this supreme elation and then trickles down into just basically me screaming into the void, "Why won't you end?" And,
oh, there's a really good joke there, but I won't make it.
Thank you, Dylan. I appreciate that. I'm really hoping, and of course, we don't know right now, but I'm really hoping that if that's taken care of, like, this game could be really, really, really good. Because I know all the stuff they fixed in for the sequel was abysmal. Like, the stuff that they had to do that was not in the original version of Bravely Default sounds horrifying. So I'm hoping that the refinements kept happening. But
yeah, it sounds like there's been a few more as well, yeah, on top of what we already got. So yeah, it's not going to be like a quantum leap compared to the version of Bravely Default that we got, but it sounds encouraging. And the big thing is, just from the reviews I've read, is there's nothing as kind of egregious as the back half of that game. But like I said, maybe there's probably a certain amount of stuff that's recycled, like I said, because it is the same world as the first game.
Right.
So that's the sort of the counter to that, is that maybe the whole game won't feel as fresh. You know, you've seen, yes, there's new jobs and there's, you know, this and that, but you have seen the battle system before, you have seen a lot of the art style before, all that kind of thing. But you know, I think I'm a pretty conservative guy. I think I'll probably just go with the one I know I enjoy rather than buy something that I end up feeling like, oh, I just, sometimes with RPGs I just never fully get into it, you know. And Bravely Default, for whatever problems it had, you know, clearly I fully got into it because I ended up going to all the way to the bitter end with it, you know. So that doesn't always happen with RPGs in me.
So I know we did the whole rundown of what Europe's getting. We got Cross Zone yesterday, and then in the next 3 hours we're getting Fire Emblem, which seems like just bad planning. Just really, really bad. Well, I mean, Project Cross Zone is just bad planning personified, but we don't have Bravely Default coming, so we're actually sort of on the backslide of the RPGs. There's like whatever that thing is, Pocolo Croy or whatever.
Oh yeah, that came out today. Pocolo Croy or whatever. It seems like it should be Pocolo Qua to me, just looking at it. But that's not the way Xseed says it. So
Pocolo Qua.
No, so yeah, that came out. That's you've got this sort of crossover with the Harvest Moon type stuff as well, Story Seasons as it's known now. So it's a kind of a pretty traditional RPG, but then got this farming stuff on the side, like very, very much to the side. You know, I don't think you really have to engage with it if you don't want to, but it's there if you do.
So even more so than Rune Factory.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Oh wow.
Just from, I mean, there hasn't been a tremendous amount of publicity around this game in our region. You know, it's digital only here. I'm not sure about outside.
I believe it is. It is retail here.
Right. But so, you know, I'm not sure if they're expected to do great things with it. And it is interesting in the maelstrom of RPGs that we're going through right now to release it now. It seems like it'll be thoroughly overshadowed. But
maybe they just don't care.
I mean, it looks nice. I do like the sort of art style and everything.
God, it's 3DS is such a weird system right now. But
I'd certainly advise anybody, you know, that's maybe thinking about getting into the Bravely Default series for the first time to try the demo, because it'll probably be more useful for them than it was for me, to be honest. But it gives you a pretty good, I think, you know, being able to judge it against the first game, it gives you a pretty good sense of what you're going to be doing. You know, you do get to fight a few bosses, learn a few new jobs, mix up the jobs a bit, some abilities. You know, it's got enough of a length. So I think my game time ended up in about 6 hours, and there was probably some extra stuff on top of that that didn't get saved. You know, if you failed attempts beating a boss or something. So you know, demos for RPGs can be kind of tricky, but I think this gives a fair reflection of the kind of experience you're probably in for. So I'd certainly advise anybody that's interested to seek it out.
Excellent. Once
it lands in other regions as well as after, obviously it's already here in Europe.
So, John, you have an RPG for us as well.
I do.
Different kind of RPG, though.
Yeah. You know, I'm getting sucked into the maelstrom, I guess. Hopefully, I'm going to be
the maelstrom of last year.
Maelstrom of last year. I'm going to be watching Greg's forecasts intently.
By the way, the game that John's going to talk about here, I have to cop to this. I have it figuratively on my shelf in shrink wrap.
You know,
I'm going to be paying close attention here, John, to see whether I should break the seal.
Okay, well, I figured I had to go back to my pledge about, you know, only talking about PS4 games, and so I'm playing through Witcher 3. Actually, Johnny Metz, God rest his soul. We kind of pinky swore that we would play through Witcher 3 as a team separately, not in the same.
Then he went and quit the show.
So. Yeah, then he went and quit the show. So I went ahead and started playing this. I got it for pretty cheap. I think Black Friday or something. So, I mean,
jumped right on it, huh?
No, well, I mean, I went through a whole bunch of other stuff like Xenoblade Chronicles X. That took a chunk out of my life.
We appreciate your devotion, John.
Yes, yes. So I decided to finally take a crack at Witcher 3. You know, I'd heard really good things, you know. You know, my take on it is it's pretty much exactly what you think what you would think it would be. You know, the plot is that you're this effectively a monster hunter. They call them witchers in these games, Geralt, and he is searching for somebody, yada yada yada. It's set in a very medieval style of world. Really beautiful game. You know, you run around third person, you have magic attacks. It's kind of Skyrim-ish, but I think it's a little bit more action-oriented than Skyrim, or maybe the action parts of it, like the combat and stuff like that, is probably a bit more refined than Skyrim is. Skyrim always kind of felt sort of wonky to me in that respect.
This is third person.
Yeah, it's right. Third person. So yeah, so it makes it a little bit easier to control rather than just, you know, like Skyrim, you just have your big massive axe sitting there hacking away at something in front of you, which I never really got too used to. But yeah, I mean, you know, you can create armor, create potions, you know, you can do all that kind of stuff. And I kind of found that's what I kept coming back to with it, is that does all this stuff really, really well, looks gorgeous, all the cutscenes are really good, but it just all feels like I've kind of played it before. Like, it doesn't really do anything that jumps out at me as being, like, novel or particularly outside the box. I mean, it's very much kind of a... It just reminds me of, like, a Grand Theft Auto open-world style game, except set in this medieval kind of this medieval world with castles and monsters that you can hunt down, and you know, you can find treasure and you can go anywhere you want, and you pick up quests from people. You know, you roll into a town and somebody says, "Oh, hey, you know, my son is missing. Go and find him." And you go off and find him, and you know, so it's right. It's really like good.
It's supposed to be more based on the northern mythology.
Nordic sort of.
Yeah, well, more Slavic.
Right, yeah. Slavic, but it still ends up looking like a Lord of the Rings wannabe, right?
Kind
of,
yeah. Like, it's just, I'm playing through it, and I keep saying, it's like, this is really good. Like, I'm actively saying, this is a really good game, but I really don't care about it. Like, if I stopped playing right now and walked away from it, I'd just be like, yeah, it's a good game, but I mean, maybe I'm just not in the mood for it. I don't know.
So let me ask you a question. So, this game, you say it's a really good game.
It is a well-crafted game made by professionals, yes.
Rigging endorsements.
Game of the year. I didn't care.
So you've made a lot. You've played a decent number of these kinds of games.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something this game is doing better than a lot of its predecessors?
The first thing that jumps to mind is riding your horse. As funny as that sounds.
Well, no, I mean, in an open world game, that might matter. So yeah, can you elaborate?
It matters because what it does is your horse kind of like the roads in the game. I mean, you're going through woods, and you know, most of what you're doing is you're out in the countryside. It's really not you know you're going from small village to small village. You really don't spend a lot of your time in cities, at least where I'm at in the game. You know, because you're going out, you're fighting monsters, you're getting quests, you're being sent here and sent over there, and there's a lot of kind of side stuff that you can do as well. So the one problem with that is it could potentially be difficult to run your horse into trees all the time and stuff like that. Just making travel throughout the world kind of awkward. But what they've done is they've made it so that if you cross over a road, your horse will kind of like latch onto it and then follow that road as long as it goes until you specifically yank your horse off of it. So it's kind of like, just think of the roads as kind of like a magnet, like a
so you
rail
can ride
that your horse
more passively.
Yeah. So you don't really have to worry about managing it. Yeah. It's an on-rails horse simulator.
You don't have to change the wind direction before you actually get on with getting to the next place.
Exactly. So can you at least make it poop on command? Because that's what
you,
I need.
Yeah, that's what you can. If you're going to do the Tywin Lannister shit in the Red Keep thing, you need a very disciplined horse.
That's right. Metal Gear has set a new standard. If you can't make all your animals... Like, can you make whatever a Slavic dragon is poop on command? Like that?
No. You also can't... You also can't tie the horse to anything and make it float away. So,
damn it.
Unfortunately, no, I know
So, John, let's break the game down a little bit, because all we've talked about so far is that it's a big open world game based on Slavic mythology. So,
correct.
We talked that it's a third person. The game runs in third person. So, what's combat like? This is
generally the bit that you hear people grumble about the most. As someone who's already heard a little bit about it, I've still this is what you hear about.
It's Zelda-ish, but you don't really have any way. You can technically lock on to things, but not in a way that's really meaningful.
It's like a loose lock on.
Yeah, you can select enemies, but it's really there's a lot of backflipping away from the enemy, and you can do side rolls to get away from the enemy.
Is it almost real time character action type stuff, or is it more like you chain up commands like you would in certain
RPGs? It's real time. Yep. Hmm. So you're doing a whole lot of dodging and backpedaling, and a lot of times it can get kind of difficult because you're fighting sometimes 7 or 8 enemies at a time. So you're really trying to break enemies off from the pack and take them out one by one, and you have heavy attacks that take a bit longer to do, and then you have light attacks. And you can fight humans. You have two different types of swords. You have a steel sword for humans, for humanoid enemies, and then you have a silver sword for monster enemies. Monsters are, of course, they're almost kind of more like boss battles in a way, because you have to lay a trap for them to get them to come by. I haven't really fought many monsters where I'm at in the plot. You have like one monster encounter at the start to kind of show you it's almost like a tutorial where it shows you sort of how to do it. But I'm sure like further on in the game, and you have monsters that, you know, are just out in the world that are hiding treasure caches and stuff like that. So you can definitely go like on specific kind of hunts to take out monsters.
And I guess that's part of the game's quest system, which is one of the things I heard praised about it. Can you speak a little bit about what the quests are like?
I mean, the quests are, I mean, they're pretty much, you know, go to this cave and kill this monster. They're nothing really out of the ordinary.
Okay.
Is it
maybe just the density of them?
Yeah, there's a lot of them. And the thing is, I will say that they're easy to find. They're typically in villages posted on boards. So they're pretty easy to have access to. That is the one thing I really like about it, is the fact that it is very streamlined. Where Skyrim always kind of falls over, in my opinion, or at least where I kind of lose it, it's almost too wide open. There's so much to do, and they keep handing you what seem like major quests and major quest lines, just left, right, and center. I mean, if you know, you can get taken down, you know, some huge like Thieves Guild quest line where you really don't know what you're even getting into, but it turns out to be this massive quest line that completely takes you off of the main story. And it's just kind of like an innocent sort of like, hey, there's, you know, you go over and ask this guy and he says something. Like, you're never really shown, like, hey, this is something major. You may want to do this over here until you kind of, you know, you may want to do this as a side quest before you get away from the main quest. And Witcher 3 is a lot better in that respect. It's very clear. You're kind of kept on a general line in terms of being on the main quest. So you're kind of, it's not linear, but you have a good idea, like, hey, go over here if you want to stay on the main quest, and anything else you do is very obviously side quests. So I think they do a really good job with that.
That's good. How's the delivery been? Story writing, etc.
It's good. It's good. Okay. The cutscenes, I mean, there's any of the reviews I've read about it, they've really praised the cutscenes. The cutscenes are really well done. And Geralt, he's a likable character. I mean, witchers in this world are not well liked. But his character is written in such a way that he's very sarcastic, and he kind of strays into sort of like the Metal Gear Snake kind of gruff, gravelly voiced sort of guy. But he has a little bit more humor than Snake does. He's a little bit more sarcastic and a little bit more insulting to people that just ask him stupid things. So he's pretty well written that way. He always throws in some barbs at, you know, dumb people that he talks to, because a lot of times you're talking to like royal guards, or you're talking to some baron who has his henchmen that walk into the bar and they try to start trouble with you and stuff like that. So he always has some choice insults. And a lot of times when you interact with these characters, you choose what you want to say. There's like a, you know, there's, you can choose from three or four different things to say. And of course, you know,
BioWare style Wheel of Deal?
A little bit. Not exactly like that, but it's pretty obvious. Like, if you choose this, you'll fight them outright, or you can try to like kind of sweet talk them. You know, there's always kind of obvious ways to get out of everything.
Your armor's looking real nice today.
No, it's like, but I mean, like, you know, you can try to pump them for information, or you can just insult them. You know, stuff like that, or you can just ask sort of a question that's kind of right in the middle that probably won't provoke anything. But gotcha. I will say though, it's rather violent, because when you actually fight humanoid enemies, I mean, you slice them in half with your sword, and you slice them. I mean, you'll slice them from their neck down through their chest, and like half of their body will fall off onto the ground.
Oh,
so, yeah. So it's violent now.
That's
so
tasty.
Yeah. So there's a lot to like, but what surprised me the most, what disappointed me the most was I'm playing on PS4. And the load times in this game are really long, and they're often. Like, when you die, for some reason, it has to reload. It sits there for like a full minute and reloads whatever. So if you're in a particularly difficult area and you die a lot and you have to reload a lot, you're staring at a loading screen a lot. So that was disappointing. I mean, I haven't really seen loading scenes like it for a while. Like, yeah.
That's a bummer.
Yeah, so it's good. I would say it's a game where if you haven't played a game like this, like something that's long, involved, you know, really like kind of free form. If you haven't played a game like this, I kind of feel like the way I was before I played Grand Theft Auto V. Before I played Grand Theft Auto V, I really hadn't played a game like that for so long that when I played it, I was like, oh, yeah, right, I haven't done this for so long. And so I was really, you know, I really enjoyed it. But after playing, you know, that a while back and after playing, you know, Xenoblade X, I'm kind of like, okay, I've just been playing it here and there, you know, spending an hour with it, spending a couple of hours with it, just kind of going through piecemeal. I haven't really had the impetus to go through and really start charging through it, but it's good.
Yeah, to be clear, when I say I figuratively have it on the show, it's because the best deal I could get on the Xbox One when I wanted to get it was the Witcher 3 digital bundle.
Oh.
Yeah, so I have the code for the game and I've just mm-hmm. never downloaded it.
Yeah.
So, because it is enormous as well. So, yeah. I guess. Similar to you, it's because I've played Xenoblade recently. I'm not itching for it anytime soon.
Yeah.
But maybe one day.
Yeah. I mean, it's a game that's easy to chip away from because you can hop on, do a couple of quests, you know, maybe.
No off TV play though. That's my chisel away. I can't do that with like normal console games anymore. Yeah. Like, it's just like, I have to get in front of the TV and everything.
First world problems with Greg Lee.
Yeah, very, very much so. Very much so.
Upper echelon first world problems.
Yeah, really.
Well, John, you know, if you keep at it and you have a change of heart, for free, let us know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested because you reacted pretty positively to like Xenoblade Chronicles X.
Oh yeah, Xenoblade Chronicles X just grabbed me and wouldn't let go. And I think I thought about that, and I think the reason why that is just because of the way, first off, Xenoblade Chronicles X, you know, it kind of has that, you know, it has the mechs, which I'm a huge, you know, I've always been like a long time kind of like anime mecha fan, even though I really don't follow it too much anymore, but it has that kind of style.
How many Gunpla have you built?
None, thank God. I never, ever went down that road. But I just really like...
listeners, you now have your challenge.
That aesthetic, that kind of mecha sort of thing. So that was always something, that was always a goal in that game that I really wanted to attain. And I just the way that game plays is more kind of what I'm accustomed to now, which is more MMO style. You can go anywhere you want, but you can also get a bunch of quests, but there's really no set order, but not like Skyrim though. Like there's just a lot of just the way that game was designed, Xenoblade meaning, it just made it really easy for me to just kind of just keep playing it and keep playing it and keep playing it. And it wasn't,
everything could be consumed so quickly.
Exactly. Yeah, it was a whole lot of content, but in bite-sized chunks. And Witcher 3 really isn't like that. You spend a lot of your time traveling. They do have fast travel in the game, which is handy. But, of course, you have to get there and open up the fast travel nodes in order to use them. So you still wind up doing a lot of traveling and you know, a lot of riding around on your horse and stuff like that. And of course, while you're going through the countryside, you'll get sidetracked by, there's a mob of people trying to, like, hang somebody, and you have to decide whether or not you let the person die or you kill everybody. You know, there's stuff like that. There's a lot of like kind of pop-up quests that come around that don't really have much to do with anything, although, you know, somebody might come back later on in the game and say, hey, you saved me. You know, there's that kind of stuff.
And but, you kill everybody else.
Yeah. Well, I kill people every time. I usually save somebody, but only if it means that I can kill a whole lot of people in the process.
That's really devotion, John.
That's how I roll, man.
He's calling it his pacifist run, by the way. All right, so I'm...
Gotta break a few eggs, man. Gotta break a few eggs to make an omelet. Jesus.
All right, well, I'm going to go next. I should be pretty quick. So, last week, we were planning on doing New Business up to a point before we cut it. So, I wanted to pull something that I hadn't played before. And I was out to pursue the sequel to a game I really enjoyed from my childhood, Mega Man Battle Network 3. So I played two, and I played one and two. One's good, two is immeasurably better with all the enhancements they made. And as a child, I ended up skipping three because they made two versions of it because Capcom are assholes. They took this game they had annualized and said, you know what else we should do? We should make a white and a blue version because Pokemon gets away with that shit. Why can't we? And the answer is there's no damn good reason for it. But they did it. And I've talked about this game, this series before because it's sort of like the proto level 5 child saves the world with insert noun here story. And it kind of plays like level 5, like a, you know, like a demake of a level 5 game or a predecessor. So I went to the eShop to go buy it, and I blacked out and ended up with Mega Man 02 again.
Don't you hate it when that happens?
So what I think happened is I saw the white and blue version, got mad at Capcom again, and said, no, I'll just buy this game I bought on the GBA and on the DS and again on the Wii U. So I've actually talked about this game twice that I know of on this show.
You're really sticking it to the man, James.
This might be number three. I'm not sure, but I'm not going to speak much about it. This game is hard. So if you haven't played the Mega Man Zero games, they're really good. Like, I really love this series. One's a little bit rough. Because they were still sort of feeling it out. It was the first new Mega Man, you know, traditional Mega Man series in a while. And of course, as the name would imply, they all start Zero, which means heavy use of his weapons. The item enhancement system is really based more on new weapon sets, not power ups. You can get power ups, but how you get them is not quite the normal Mega Man way. They don't really matter as much. So instead, you might get like a grappling hook or a Yeah, and then you can just, like, it clips into the wall, and you can swing over gaps, or you get a shield that you can charge up and throw out, like, a boomerang and stuff like that, versus just the normal, which is his sword and his gun. So, like I said, one's pretty rough, and two and three are sort of the pinnacle of the series. Four turned into this, like, weird world exploration thing that they really sort of run away with in Mega Man ZX on the DS, which I've also talked about on the show. So I figured I'd go with two. I guess in my blacked out state, and I forgot how hard that game is. That game is really difficult. So I've beaten two on the GBA, which I beat it. The game has essentially one difficulty mode, which is just play the game. And then when you beat that, you unlock one that's like, oh, you really think this is a good idea, huh? Do you think you're a big shit, huh? You want to try it? You want to try this? You're not gonna have fun with this. The DS collection, the Mega Man Zero collection, put the four GBA games together on the one DS cart and introduced an easy mode. So I beat the GBA game as a child, and I realized I was able to do that. And I beat the DS collection on easy, on regular, and then I actually went through and beat some of the games on their unlockable hard modes. And I realized the reason I can't beat this game right now is I went straight from 01 to 02, and I went straight from easy mode collection to regular mode collection. You cannot just pick this game up because it just kicks you right in the teeth. It took me a really long time to beat this game. Like, just unfathomably long. But it just reminded me that there's this itch of this kind of, like, action hack and slash Mega Man but with a sword game that I really wanted to play. And somehow I ended up on the beta test group of a game called 20XX. Which is a Mega Man inspired game that is currently available on early access in Steam. It's based heavily on the Mega Man X series, insofar as you have a Mega Man looking, she's female, but a Mega Man looking dude who shoots a Buster gun out of his hand or her hand, and a Zero looking dude who has a beam saber. So I mean, it's like they knew what they were cribbing. But what makes this a little bit different, or a lot different really, is that the game is a roguelike. So it is a Mega Man X inspired roguelike. So as you play each, basically you start the game off, you pick a character.
This sounds like a scientific experiment to see if it's possible to get you to like a roguelike.
Yeah, it kind of is.
I fully endorse any experiments done on James Jones.
Thank you. Until they can make an Ace Attorney roguelike, this is what they're going to have to live with.
Wow.
So I've been playing it as the Zero knockoff character. I haven't even bothered to learn their names. Like, I'm just straight up calling them X and Zero because it's
kind of like that with Bloodstained, isn't it? I mean, yeah. You know, it's Alucard and Shinoa. It isn't, but it is.
Yeah, it's just not even worth trying to learn their names. Like, they've got dumb names anyway. It's just like, you know what, fine. As long as you don't make an Axel character, I don't care. That joke's going to really resonate with five people listening to this show. But
Is it the same five people from earlier or a different five?
It's probably the same five people, actually.
Could you draw me a Venn diagram?
If you know who Axel is, congratulations. But this game, how it works is the stage order isn't. It's not like a Mega Man game where you say, okay, here are your bosses. Here are the, you know, the eight bosses or the six, or depending on what series you're dealing with. Zero actually splits them into four and four usually. You say, I'm going to start the game. And you're warped to a stage, and it's a random stage, like out of the set of boss stages. I want to say there is eight, but it's hard to tell because you can't see them all in one place. Because The stage is randomly generated. There are some components that always show up in the stage, some platforming puzzles that are always there, but by and large, the stage is randomly generated. And as you kill enemies, you collect nuts, which is the in-game currency. They need to really think about that before they rename it before it comes out of early access. Or soul nuts, which persist beyond death. Again. And also these power-ups that are only good for the run you're on. So they may increase your attack, they may increase your jump height, they may increase your speed, stuff like that. And in fact, sometimes you can get replacement weapons for the character. So the zero wannabe. Like, I replaced his sword with a spear because I found it in one of the chests that's hidden off on like a side puzzle. Like, because nothing persists, you have to go on like these little side paths and you unlock a chest, but it's really only for that run. And basically, you get to the end of the stage. Stage is usually cleared in like 2 minutes flat. They're really easy. You fight the boss. The bosses are not very good. I mean, I'm really disappointed with the bosses in the game. The platforming is usually fine, even though, because it's all randomly generated, it just looks like floating shit in space. Like, it doesn't look like a level. It doesn't look crafted, because obviously it isn't.
Yeah.
But the game feels right. The game feel is actually really spot on. The sprites look kind of, you know, a bad Western, like, they look like they're drawn by somebody who had the How to Draw Like Your Favorite Animes book that they bought from the Scholastic Book Fair. Like, it's a rough scene, but it feels okay. So there's this sense of, like, I can get in there and just start playing it because it feels good. So you clear a stage, and then you're given the choice to pick from three of the bosses. And basically, as you proceed through the stages, your health does not regenerate unless you find health pickups. Your weapon power is the same. And really, all you're trying to do is get deeper and deeper into the game and collect soul nuts. I know. Because when you die, the soul nuts you picked up, which are not the regular nuts, and there's only a limited number in each stage. I know, John. John, you want to just get it out now?
I'm good, man. I'm just going to mute my headset right now.
There's actually an item called a sack of nuts, John. Are you done?
It's too good. It's too good.
I know.
All right, I'm done.
So those you collect that persist after death, you can go into a shop before you start the game again and buy a one-time use upgrade for your character, like the same stuff you can find in the stage, or you can buy additional items to drop. So these basically, you start to get the first when you very first start the game, there's only a very limited number of power-ups that will drop. And as you buy stuff, you buy new power-ups that'll drop. Some of them more powerful, some of them make other ones show up more frequently, and you can just sort of get more and more of these things as you go. But the goal really is to just get deeper and deeper into the game every time until you finally manage to get to the final game's boss, which I pulled off in 4 or 5 hours total, I think. And it's, you know, there's definitely problems with this game. It definitely feels a little bit low rent. It's definitely got some, like, the random stages is kind of eh, and the inability to really sit down and go, okay, I'm going to go this boss is a little rough, and the bosses themselves are not good. I can pretty much beat all of them without getting hit. It's just, it feels like the game feel is so there, and that's what I really wanted out of a game. I just wanted that feeling of playing a late Mega Man X, early Mega Man Zero game, and just really getting in there and getting to do that again in new stages with my same old characters that I really like, even though they're technically not the same characters. And I also wanted to point out that Mighty No. 9 is still not out.
So does Gunvolt not scratch this itch? I haven't played that.
So Gunvolt is divisive on this show. I don't like the Gunvolt combat system because I feel like it slows you down.
The tagging.
Yeah. Like to me, when I play a game like that, I mean Integrate's made the Mega Man Zero games. Like when I play their games, I want how I play a Mega Man Zero game is I blitz through the game. Like I am boosting and boosting into jump slashes and landing right next to the enemy as I land the slash. Or it's a charge slash, and I'm boosting into it, and I'm unleashing it right as I reach the platform. So as I slam down, I hit the enemy and kill it. Like, I'm not stopping. I am going at maximum speed until I reach a platforming puzzle that doesn't quite fit on the GBA screen, which you think that wouldn't be an issue because they designed it for the GBA. But it is. So there's a lot of blind faith jumps in those games. But to me, it's about playing that game at speed. Like, to me, Mega Man X series was about speed, but the Mega Man Zero series is really about speed. Because you really, unlike X, where you can kind of hang back and blast, Zero's gun's not very good, and Zero's Z-Saber is unbelievable, so you want to get right up on them. But because everything in that game is super dangerous, and because health is such a commodity in that game, and because it's so hard to beat it on its own, you really have to deal that damage quick. So that game in particular, speaking of Gunvolt, is that the whole tagging mechanic really requires you to sort of like stop, I'm going to tag this enemy six times, and then I'm going to unleash my attack on them.
Yeah, I disagree. Because you do have a certain amount of customization for your character, and I customized mine to be fast, and I didn't feel like I had to stop and tag. Like, I was very... It was very easy to jump right up to an enemy's face and tag it and tag the next one next to it and then press the shoulder button and zap them both very quickly and move on.
You see, But even then, you had to like, okay, I'm gonna get up to this guy, I'm gonna tag, attack. Like, I just move through, just not stopping. Like, to me, that's what I want. I want Zero's feet to never touch the ground, basically. Like, I want him to just be a blur through the stage. And as I was getting my sea legs under me with Zero Two, you know, I restarted my game a couple times because how that stupid game works is you have to clear the bosses with like a good enough letter grade to unlock their power ups. So I would just restart and run at them again. And like, I got to the point where I was just hammering through that stage at just, you know, just this blur and was clearing the stage in half the time it took before. And that's just kind of what I want. I want to feel like I am an overpowering force of destruction that just waylays everything in their way and just pushes them aside like I'm parting the Red Sea. Like, I don't want to have any, like, I don't want to have to stop until the bosses. And then I want the bosses to be just tooth and nail tough fights. And the problem is I'm getting the first part out of 20XX. I'm feeling like a badass and feeling like I am just running guys down. But I'm not getting that second part. I'm not getting the challenging boss fights. I'm not getting the well-crafted levels. I'm not getting the really good art. Mega Man X games have really, really good art. Like, really staggeringly good. Some of the best sprite work I've seen in a while. And that's sad because it's been a while since those games came out. Like, for that kind of game, really, really solid sprite work on that system. And a lot of games have come along trying to ape that style and haven't quite nailed it. I don't know, it's one thing I haven't tried in 20XX is apparently there's multiplayer, which seems like it would just be a complete cluster. So I kind of want to try it. I feel like that would be the kind of idiocy this game so rightly deserves. But it's not a bad game. Like, I really commend them for nailing the game feel, because even people who have made these games and had the game feel have struggled to nail the game feel. So that's really the hardest part of making one of these. So maybe before it comes out of early access, they'll you know, tighten up some of the stuff. Maybe they'll work on the character models a little bit, make things work a little bit better, tone the bosses up slightly. But there's the hardest part they've got. So maybe I just need to hang out for 20XY. And maybe that'll fix the issues and I'll find the game that's really engrossing. But at the same time, like I said, it feels good. I think there's a demo. If you have it, if you like these kinds of games, if you really like the Mega Man X series, a bit more than the Zero series, because the game feel is aping X more than Zero. Go ahead and give it a shot. At the worst, you go, all right, I'm done. But I think there's some stuff here that works out really well. So, Guillaume.
Yes. So, I've also got some Nintendo new business here to talk about. I mentioned during our top five episode that my Nintendo of last year was Life is Strange.
You did.
I was not done with the game yet, but I finished since then the last two episodes. It's an episodic game. There's five episodes. So I finished those, and it's still a very, very good game. So yeah, Life is Strange. It's kind of in the same vein as a Telltale game, where it's descended from point-and-click adventure games, but it's got more of a focus on telling a story and kind of telling it, you know, giving you branching paths and having you make certain decisions that will have repercussions down the line. And it's really well done for what it is. It's by the studio Don't Nod. They made Remember Me a
while
ago.
Which no one does.
Yeah, no. I played it. I liked certain aspects of it. It was this weird third-person action game where the combat was terrible, but they really built an interesting world. And so here in in this type of game that Life is Strange is, I think that their strengths as a studio really can shine without being brought down by bad gameplay. So yeah, Life is Strange. You're playing this teenager, Max Caulfield, who's away from home. Like, she's studying in this Blackwell Academy. She's studying photography, and the game begins, and you're in this kind of apocalyptic scenery where there's this tornado really, really close, and you're walking up to this lighthouse. Like, you dream that everything gets destroyed and you died, but then you wake up, you're in class, and you've got your obnoxious teacher giving his lecture, and then you go to the bathroom, and there you witness, like, you're kind of hidden from view, you're taking a picture of, like, some butterfly. The school's dealer comes in, and he's having an argument with this girl, and he ends up shooting her. You're hiding there, and you end up somehow rewinding time, and then you wake up again on your desk in class, and you kind of relive those scenes and wondering what the hell's going on, and then you actually stop the murder. Turns out that the girl that you saved is your childhood friend. I'm terrible at telling this game story.
Yes, but... you want me to help?
Sure.
Yeah, so basically it's your friend who's full of, I believe the game describes it as, empty rebellion.
Really?
I want to say that's what her stepfather describes her as.
Right. She's the rebel, and Max is very much kind of the shy, studious, nerdy student. And
she's the teenage rebel. You know, just
right.
Everybody sucks, adults are terrible.
Right.
Yes, and I think when you play this game, the first two chapters, the writing's not as good as it gets.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the characters are really kind of... I kind of fucking hated everybody for the first two chapters.
Right.
Like, I saw the apocalypse, and I went, you know, that wouldn't be so bad.
Yeah, well, it's hard to empathize with teenagers, right? Because, you know, like, we've all been there, and we realize, wow, what a bunch of idiots.
Right.
So really, like, we see ourselves and we realize, wow, I was so stupid. But yeah. Eventually the characters grow on you. Max is not as obnoxious as an art student could be. So she's got that going on.
I'm sorry, but... I went to an art school. Yes, yeah, you're right.
Entirely,
she isn't.
It's entirely true.
But still, you know, like, you end up, you know, caring about these characters in this place, and I really, eventually, you end up believing in this friendship that she has with Chloe, her childhood friend. Like, they rebond, you know, after, you know, you save her life, and you tell her all about your new superpower. And together, you end up trying to discover, like, to solve this mystery of this this girl who disappeared months ago. There's a lot going on in this game, and I you know, it seems like they tried to throw a lot of things in. You know, you've got the superpower, you've got the disappearance, kind of like maybe a kidnapper or a murderer, you don't know, but you've also got these scenes of teenage girls, like, bonding and just being teenagers. And personally, I think that the game's at its strongest when it's just, like, these mundane scenes. Life at school as a teenager, kind of dealing with bullies and or with homework or with, you know, whatever it is that
and
they throw at you.
Ghost ears and whatever other... 'Cause, I mean... That's the thing. Like, half of the game is sort of, I don't want to say mundane stuff,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, in a lot of ways, it is.
Yeah.
Well, Max is mundane. Chloe decides she's kind of like a Scooby-Doo character at some point. Like,
right.
We've got to break into the principal's office. What? Why? Just
right.
Call the police, yo. And then also occasionally, like, visions, spirit quest visions, like,
mm-hmm.
like almost David Cagey and stuff, but not stupid.
Right.
But so there's that weird dichotomy you're always kind of working with in this game.
Yeah.
That generally works.
Yeah. Well, I think they have a lot of trouble balancing it. And the thing is, I think that they bit a little bit more than they could chew, and just eventually all the sides of it, the friendship, I think, holds up really well. Like, the mundane stuff holds up really well, but the murder mystery part of it ends up very tropey.
Yes.
And you can see it coming, and eventually, you know, you might face come face to face with the kidnapper or the murderer or whoever, and it just the scene goes on for way too long. Like, they expose their evil plan, and they talk to you way too long, and it's just like it's very, very
it's a James Bond movie. Now I am going to tell you all of the details of my plan.
And then you've got like the
there's nothing you can do to stop me unless you press that button.
I know
as long as that button is not pressed, I'm in control.
I know you have magic powers, but I'm not worried about it. There's no way that you could use those against me.
Exactly.
Right. But and the time travel stuff as well ends up very tropey, and I was talking on Twitter to some people about the game, and someone brought up a good point that I had also noticed, like the time travel tropes that seem to be there just for the sake of being there, like because that's how you write a time travel story. You always got to warn, like, don't change the past because you're going to fuck things up.
There's that cliffhanger one between episodes.
Right. I'm not even talking about that. Like, there's this kind of message overhaul of don't mess up the timeline. And it's like, well, what the fuck? Like, what was I supposed to do? This power was thrust upon her, you know? Like,
she didn't choose to have this power. But ultimately, the only way to proceed is by screwing up the timeline. But then the game comes back around and goes, don't screw up the timeline.
Right.
It's like, well, I just spent screwing up the timeline for the last three episodes and was rewarded for it constantly, so...
So you've got these time travel tropes, and they're there, and they don't really stand up. You know, like, it just feels like that they threw stuff at the wall and tried to see what stuck, and perhaps in the end didn't really kind of fully bring it all together.
I kind of wondered if the episodic nature of the game hurt them a little bit on that. Because they didn't sit down and write a full narrative in one shot.
They clearly had time to implement some changes or to take in some feedback, but they put foreshadowing in the game that eventually leads nowhere, and there are many elements of the end that they didn't really properly foreshadow.
Yeah.
But overall, still, I still enjoy the game. Like, I still enjoy the characters. I still enjoyed, like, I have a very good overall positive impression of this game because, and I think this goes back to something that John mentioned about The Witcher 3, like, it's the opposite case here where, you know, it's something that he's seen before in games, like the whole Lord of the Rings thing in The Witcher 3. And here, the setting, like this kind of like West Coast high school or college with these teenagers, like it's not a setting. These are not situations that you see a lot in video games. So it feels fresh. And because of that, I'm willing to forget the game a lot, you know? It's not unlike Heavy Rain, where we make a lot of fun, you know, rightfully, we make fun of it because
I mean that game
Jason.
Just lies to you though. I mean that game
it does,
and that's awful.
Yes, but up to the point where you find out that it's kind of full of shit, it's kind of an enjoyable experience. At least I enjoyed it. Like it was just because the whole like whodunit aspect of Heavy Rain was not something that you saw a lot of video games at the time. It felt fresh, and I was willing to forgive it a lot.
I would say that the most Life is Strange, to me, the biggest thing I hope this contributes is it finally kills the Telltale engine. Like that thing needs to go. It is old as hell at this point, and they just keep pushing these things out. And I think that ultimately, besides hearing that Tyrion Lannister will remember that again, like it's time for that engine to really and really those gameplay mechanics to be reworked. Because this game approaches a lot of the same buttons, like trying to push a lot of the same buttons and tell the same kind of narrative and work the same sort of way. You know, the branching narrative, the decision making. I think now with games coming along outside of the Telltale space, this was obviously inspired in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Telltale was
yeah. Doing. And there's even like in the first few episodes, you get a message saying like this action will have repercussions.
Yeah.
But eventually, they go away from that. Like, I think it stops popping up, and
it's
that's
little,
a good thing.
It's a little butterfly that flutters. Like, they dial it down a lot.
Right. And so,
Chloe will remember that. Never pops up on the screen. but to me, like, it will be good to see if this finally pushes content creators like Telltale to go, okay, we've gotten away with making the same engine over and over and over again. Let's really stretch what we can do and put more functionality into our game.
Yeah, well, I hope so, because there's a lot of good ideas in Life is Strange. Like, the time travel thing, they really implement well. You can rewind time to go back on certain decisions. And, of course, there are story reasons why you can't undo all the, you know, important choices that happen. So there, you can't stop every tragedy, right? And there's some tragic stuff that can happen in this game. But they also implement the time travel and the puzzles, you know, like there's mm-hmm. the set of rules that they follow where basically if you can affect the world in some way and kind of, let's say like you drop this box and then you use it to climb up someplace, but then you need the box to be up where you are again, you can rewind time and Max is going to stay where she is, but the box is going to, you know, fly back up again. And then you can use the box again to continue like with the next puzzle. So that's just, you know, one example.
See,
but
I thought those were kind of cheesy. To me, the ones where it worked was where you had to kind of pump somebody for information.
Right.
And then
you rewind and then you know all the information and they don't even know that they told you everything.
Or
right?
or they're freaked out that you know everything.
Right.
And they concede almost immediately.
So yeah, lots of cool ideas, cool touches, and you know, like I've got a lot of criticisms about the story, but in the end, positive impression. And Karen said like more of this, please, you know. So and she's, you know, a freaking Shakespeare professor, so I, you know, the story didn't drag it down too much. Like we were willing to forgive a lot of problems with Life is Strange because just, you know, it's a good setting. It's a good idea. A lot of things executed well, but just maybe the writing eventually didn't really live up to it.
Fair enough. So, Guillaume, do you want to talk about Kuru Kuru Kudurin or do you want to say
Kuru Kuru Kudurin.
Kuru Kuru Kudurin. So that's a game that came out last week on the Virtual Console, and it's one of those import games on the Virtual Console that we never got in North America before now. It's this GBA game that came out close to the launch.
It was pretty close to the launch, and we got it over here, that one. But then there was a sequel for GBA that came later called Kuririn Paradise, I think, that was mm-hmm. did not come to Europe or America, of course.
Right.
And then a GameCube sequel called Kuririn Squash in 2004, which did not get released anywhere else. But I recently imported that. Now that Beautiful Joe is about to come out of the drive, I might well be playing that quite soon.
Nice. So yeah, this is my second time playing a Kuririn game because I had played someone's import copy of the sequel, the GBA sequel. But this is good. Like so what we got in North America is the localized European version, and so you've got a manual that's in freaking like 5-6 languages.
Yeah, because you get the nice the actual scans of the original
yep.
manual with GBA Virtual Console.
Yep, and so you've got all the text that goes with it. The important, you know, because of course the story in this game where you're controlling this rotating stick through levels, through obstacle courses, is very, very important. Actually, the game has more personality than I expected. Like, I did not know that you had this little mascot character, this little bird, Kuririn, who's supposed to go through these levels to rescue his sisters and brothers. But turns out, like, every time, before every level, like, you see the little bird get into its helicopter thing with very, very slowly moving blades. And so that's what you're controlling. So yeah, the game's all about navigating not mazes, but really obstacle courses. The stick is rotating constantly at a constant speed, clockwise, let's say at the beginning of the stage. And you've got these corridors, that are, you know, can be wide but often become more narrow at certain parts. So you have to basically time it to cross these narrow passages when your stick is oriented in the right position. You know, that's just like the very basic premise. But very soon, you know, not only you'll have narrow passages, but you'll also have like different turns that you have to go through at the exact right speed, and you have to be very careful controlling your stick through these levels. They'll keep complicated things with then all of a sudden, like, you can't really make it through a passage if your stick is rotating clockwise. So you're going to have to find some springs to bump off of and change the rotation of your stick. It's hard to describe, but it's really well made, and it's this very arcadey action. And it's got that one more turn kind of feel, like where when we talked about F-Zero GX, like the retroactive, I said that I had very quickly developed a muscle memory for pressing start and retry. And that kind of that happens here as well, because you know you're not only timed on these levels, and you can try to make it on the top three best times for each level, but also the game tracks when you manage to go through a level flawlessly. And that's just my kryptonite, you know, like I cannot not do that. So every time, like, okay, start, retry, every time I touch a wall. And it's addictive in this good way, you know?
So I tell you, they get pretty tough. Obviously, this came out. But yeah. Because it wasn't an import game. I didn't play it on GBA, but because it was an import game, I guess it was higher in the queue for us. So we had it, I think, at Christmas 2014, roughly. Right. You know, and it gets tough towards the end to get through.
Yeah, I get the feeling. I get the feeling I'm going to stop very soon trying to perfect every stage, because I'm my own worst enemy at this. You know, like in this game, you can always, the stages are fair but tough, and you're your own worst enemy. You know, like you'll be in a passage where, okay, I've done this 10 times before, it's very easy, and whoops, oh, okay, I was careless and I touched a wall. And
well, just like when to rush and when not to rush, you know, that's the thing that gets me sometimes when you're in the midst of some of these tougher levels, is sometimes you really should, you know, if you slow down, you know, you're going to end up just making it harder on yourself. Whereas right. if you, in other cases, you just have to. You have to slow down, you know. So it's kind of, it's a little, you could get caught out sometimes on things even that you've done before, but, you know, sometimes you start rushing things that you shouldn't be rushing because, oh, I've done this however many times, but then I get to the end of the level and I lose, and you start getting worse at the bits that you'd already thought you'd mastered. Yep. And yeah, that's probably when it's best to step away. And like I said, I kind of went back to this recently because it was sort of more topical, and I was getting the GameCube one and stuff, and just like, so I got thrown in at the deep end, having not played it for a few months. Yeah. But I eventually got back up to speed, and I'm like, I think I'm on the last level now. So, it's good. Yeah, really, really good. I'm glad.
No, I enjoy it.
Obviously, GBA games were always pretty importable, you know, compared to other stuff. You know,
right, no region lock.
There's no region lock. So I assume there's plenty of people out there that have enjoyed this game, especially, you know, that early GBA phase. There was, you know, the history of Nintendo World Report. I mean, that's, you know, there was a hell of a lot of import coverage, you know, that we used to do. But, you know, I'm glad it's out there again for more people to get a look at, because it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I guess one of the problems I have so far with the game is that while the presentation is surprisingly good, it's also an early GBA game, which means that it's from that time when Nintendo went voice sample crazy. And so this game suffers from the same ill, like the martinetization of Mario games on the GBA, except here it's that at the beginning of every stage you hear this shouting start, except it sounds like start, you know, and every time when you've got this reflex of starting over every time that you touch a wall, and you just hear start, it just gets annoying really fast, so I had to turn up
that reminds me of the joys of the monkey ball announcer.
Annoying.
But very good game, and I'm going to keep playing it. I'm not that far into it so far. I'm sure that they mix up, like they add more obstacles and stuff so I'm looking forward to seeing what else the game has
excellent
down the line.
And if you are interested in playing as I guess you're the propeller of a helicopter as viewed from above,
right,
you can go try it right now on the eShop in all regions, I believe, which is fantastic. But on that, that's going to wrap it up for New Business this week. And when we come back, we'll be having Retroactive on Beautiful Joe. It's Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. We'll be right back. First up this week, we have a review, Project Cross 72 on 3DS by Zach Miller. You really can't beat a game that causes Zach Miller to hate himself. If that's not review proof, I don't know what is. Check out why Zach loves, yet hates, this wacky sequel in his no-holds-barred review.
Yeah, it's pretty much more Project Exo.
Yeah, the problem is, like, this game, and I've made this joke on the show, this game, I know I'm going to buy it at some point, and I'm going to regret it immensely, but not till I've already dumped, like, 55 hours into it.
Yeah, Zach said exactly the same thing. He said, he said something to the effect of, at a certain point, you realize you've spent so much time with it that you hate the game, hate the mechanics, hate all the characters, and hate yourself.
Yep. And then you realize, I'm right at the end, I just have to finish this thing.
Yep.
That's the darkest part. That's the last chapter in the book that makes you sad when you realize I've dumped 55 hours into this. I'm an hour off. Let's just do it. And it's the worst, most painful hour of video gaming you will ever play. Because it's no different than the first hour of that game you played. Speaking of a lot of video game, a lot of 3DS RPG video games in this case, we have the review of Fire Emblem Fates from 3DS by Kim Keller. Everybody loves Fire Emblem Awakening. So how does the new Fire Emblem Triad hold up? How do Fates, Conquest, and Birthright compare to each other? And should you buy all three? How ashamed should you feel if you went and bought the Barth Amiibo? All is revealed in Kim's review. Okay, not the Amiibo stuff. But the answer there is very. You should feel very ashamed.
Yep. Just for buying an Amiibo, period.
Oh, John, how many Amiibo do you own?
I have one.
Just the one?
I have one Amiibo, and it's the 8-bit Mario one. All right, which I think I get a pass on. It's not a real Amiibo.
How is it not a real Amiibo?
I'm not diving in the deep Amiibo waters. You know, I'm not getting I'm not getting silver Mario, and you know,
hey, and gold Mario.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
When are you buying the Bayonetta Amiibo?
Never. Maybe.
Oh, Maybe.
All right, we have a review of
Bravely Master Chief Amiibo.
Switching topics, we have a review of Bravely Second End Lair for 3DS by Don Koopman. With sequels, you always have to ask if it's more of the same or a true leap forward, and Don goes in depth to tell you exactly what's what in Bravely Default End Lair. This is an impressive streak of non-Kusagate for Don. I feel like I don't even know him anymore. I don't know.
That's a lot of 3DS RPG sequels.
Yeah, that's what it is. Well, you know, we're in the eye of the storm here.
We haven't hit the eye yet.
We are in the maelstrom. Yeah, I guess we have to check Greg's forecast to see if...
Yeah, Popolo Croy is the eye of the storm.
Where we're at. Going all Jim Cantore on us. Greg Leary.
We're at the Blackwatch Plaid level of security watches for these RPG deluge.
Oh, God. All right. We have a video. It's a Nintendo New York store tour. Neil Rodahan attends the opening of the remodeled Nintendo store in NYC and takes you along for the ride. Watch Neil get ignored by Luigi and drool over DK barrels with charging plugs. They're actually pretty cool. Of course, he can't let the opportunity pass to troll the ignoring of the Metroid franchise. Respect, Neil. Respect.
So you're telling me that the short version of this is Neil went shopping and videotaped it?
Yeah. There's actually a lot of stuff in that video that I would buy. As you know, there's some pretty cool stuff. None of them are Amiibo, might I add. None of them.
The Amiibo stand is different.
Yeah, none of them.
It's got charging plugs.
None of them. I might, you know, I have to say, if I actually had money and, you know, and I had the swing and pad... I would have one of those DK barrels. I gotta say, I would have one of those.
So. That's a different kind of swinging pad, John.
Hey.
You can swing on our DK barrels for all this and more right now at NintendoWorldReport.com. And we're back. It's time for our retroactive on Beautiful Joe for the GameCube. This is the Capcom Brawler beat-em-up starring a Power Ranger-style action hero parody movie thing that Capcom released back in 2002, I believe.
Mm-hmm. It was 2003.
It was 2003.
Okay. This was part of the infamous Capcom 5, which were five GameCube I'm air quoting here, exclusive titles that Capcom was going to develop for the GameCube with the hopes that this would sort of promote the GameCube as a console, which had already started to slip behind its competitors. Well, that was Nintendo's hope. Capcom was in it for the cash. But the games were the PNO3, Beautiful Joe, Dead Phoenix, Resident Evil 4, and Killer 7. We've actually did a retroactive on Killer 7, if I recall correctly, did we not?
We did, long ago.
I have talked about PNO3 on this show for some reason. Dead Phoenix we can obviously not talk about because it does not exist.
Yeah, never came out. PN3, by the way, there's a trailer for that in Beautiful Joe.
There is,
gallery,
yes.
So, yeah.
And it's about the same experience as playing PNO3.
I played it during my retirement. I kind of like it.
Yeah, it's got some things to it. It's got some things to
it. Is it similar to Vanquish? Just, if anybody's played Vanquish,
Just... Yeah, with the platinum kind of Mikami connection, which we'll get into with this. It's patently unfinished.
Yes. Nakedly unfinished. Like when you go outside, you're like, "Oh, this." They never finished the outside, did they? It's just an empty space, and then you move to the other dome. Okay. But so PNO3 was that Veronica Z. Schneider game where you stand behind a girl who kind of dances while she shoots enemies. Third-person shooter. Beautiful Joe, which we're going to talk about. Dead Phoenix was like a third-person flying action game where you, like, action shooter where you were behind this dude with wings shooting enemies. I don't know that it was ever playable. I don't think it was. Resident Evil 4 obviously is one of the all-time classics and greatly influenced the third-person shooter action adventure genre. Spun off all sorts of things like Gears of War and I'm blanking on what it reset where the Resident Evil series was going. And Killer 7 is that terrible game that Carl likes. No, that's not fair. I actually kind of did Killer 7 in some ways, but it is of course responsible for the career, I suppose, is the way you would describe it, of
Suda51.
Yeah, Suda51 and his Grasshopper manufacture. So, of course, I air quoted these as exclusives because many of these games, in fact,
PN3 is the only one that remained exclusive.
Yeah, all the others ended up on the PS2 in kind of weird hobbled forms. And of course, Resident Evil's been ported to everything since then.
Yeah, oh yeah.
The biggest legacy, at least in my mind, of the Capcom 5 is A, Nintendo and Capcom had a bit of a falling out after this. But more pressingly is that you have people like Kamiya, who worked on Beautiful Joe, he also worked on Devil May Cry and stuff like that, sort of moving into their own. Of course, Mikami worked on a couple of these games. Obviously, he worked on Resident Evil 4 since I think that game started development in 1999 and came out in 2005?
Well, they kind of went through the whole, aborted, version
of
it.
They started it four times, I think. And then, of course, Shinji Mikami worked on Resident Evil 4. He also worked on PNO3, which we spoke about, and ultimately he worked – that turned into Vanquish. And now he is doing stuff – God, I can't remember who he's – he's working for ZeniMax and made – shoot, what was that?
Evil Within.
He made like 15 Resident Evil games in 4 years and said, I don't do this anymore. And then 5 years later, he's at ZeniMax making a Resident Evil game. So – there you go. But a lot of these, this is where we see Clover really starting to come into their own and ultimately becoming, platinum. We see a lot of these players in Capcom really either they were established and they got big credits to their name or becoming established and really setting the tone for that company for another few years until a lot of their talent ended up departing the company.
No, I kind of, one thing, because there was such a big gap between me playing Beautiful Joe, which I played, very near its release in 2003, to then playing Wonderful 101 all those years later, in terms of a somewhat similar kind of action game from Platinum. Then subsequently having played the Bayonetta games. It's amazing how much this game set down the template for all the future Platinum Clover games. I mean, the bit I'm missing in that is DMC. I didn't play I haven't played any Devil May Cry game, so I'm not sure how much was already there from that. And then they kind of, took it into side scrolling with Beautiful Joe and then put it back into third person action with Bayonetta, but it's with just so many things about this game. Certain gameplay elements, but all sorts of it. Just the way that they virtually all got to end with a battle around the Earth, in space. they've got to reuse environments, typically by introducing some lava into them. It's just so many things like that is so Platinum in general. Platinum didn't even exist at this point, but yeah, and the way where your performance is graded and all that kind of stuff. Like it really did establish a template that they're still using now. It seems like it's the template they're sort of going to ever more places. Like they talked about the Transformers game they did. They're doing a Turtles game next. Now it's like Activision just seems to want to enslave them to churning out this template.
They described Beautiful Joe in particular as a quote staffed focused game, which is a game essentially that's kind of small focused that Capcom was really funding with the intention of increasing the staff specifically of Kamiya. But to your point, he had already worked on Resident Evil 2 and he had obviously directed Devil May Cry. And this was sort of their chance to sort of give him more, let him run this game and really polish up his skills, which a lot of these Capcom 5 games, with the obvious exception of Resident Evil 4, which was probably their most valuable franchise at that moment in time. Like they weren't gonna screw around with Resident Evil. Seemed to be focused on this, like on developing people. So it's kind of funny that pretty much everybody who worked on these games left Capcom within the next 5 years.
Right. Well, at that time, Beautiful Joe was made by Team Beautiful, became Clover later when the port on PlayStation 2 came out. And then the Okami and God Hand. But none of those games was really as successful as Capcom wanted, right? Beautiful Joe had other chances. Like there was the DS game, there was Beautiful Joe 2, there was a Red Hot Rumble, which was kind of this weird party game that came out for PSP, PS2, and GameCube.
Yes.
But again, that really, the sales weren't there. Apparently, Beautiful Joe 3 was teased around 2004. There was a website made, but soon after that, Team Beautiful or Clover was disbanded.
Yep, and then they went on to form Platinum, or at least some of them did.
Yeah.
It feels like Capcom missed about a million opportunities with these games. Yeah. Like, they succeeded in spite of... Like, they had a good ideas, and then their talent pushed them through. Keep in mind, at the same time, while these games were going on, Capcom was also making Steel Effing Battalion. Like, a game that was all about them investing a ton of money on a product.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a weird situation where you're making this big, expensive thing and trying to make money on it, whereas Beautiful Joe had a relatively modest budget, and the game was relatively successful.
Right, but to me, the feeling at the time, Beautiful Joe, I really fell in love with, and then Beautiful Joe 2 came out the next year.
But yeah, very soon after.
Yeah, and we were in a period of time when Castlevania games were coming out almost every year on the GBA, Mega Man Zero was coming out every year.
And NT.
Yeah.
Or Battle Network. They were putting out two Mega Man games every year.
Right. And I think people were just getting fatigued of Capcom's annualization of these different franchises. And Beautiful Joe, I think it hooked people because it was something new. It was unique. It was, a very distinct art style. The powers are not something that you would find in other kind of side scroller games, the whole slowing down time and zooming in and stuff like that. It's very visually interesting.
Right.
And it was not like a gameplay wrinkle that was overdone at that point.
No, it's funny.
So
it's,
Capcom got on it.
Well, yeah.
It's funny because it kind of came out of that period of time, the years following the release of The Matrix, where it's like everybody wanted to get some kind of slowing down time, bullet time.
Yeah. Things like Max Payne.
And it was usually going to be like in cutscenes or something, but everyone would get with this, they managed to integrate it into the gameplay in a really fun way, and especially considering it's totally different aesthetic from The Matrix.
Well, and it was thematically appropriate.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't feel like they were ripping it off or if it was gratuitous or anything. It's very much of that kind of zeitgeist, you know, of that time, you know, basically the time sort of between The Matrix and the sequels coming out. But at the same time, like, it totally fit its own identity too. It definitely one of my favorite sort of things to come out of that era.
Let's roll into a little bit, talk about our experiences with the game closer to when it came out. So, I got it near-ish launch. I think 2 was about to come out by the time I got it. And I think what immediately struck me about the game was just the visual. This wasn't the first time we had seen cel-shaded stuff on the GameCube. In fact, I believe we were already aware of what Zelda was going to become at this point.
Waker was out. Waker was already out by the time you...
Okay.
Yeah, cel-shading was all the rage at this time, really.
I guess that's another thing in which it kind of feels a little bit, you know, kind of the product of its time.
Yeah.
But again, it had enough of its own flair to it, you know, that kind of, it's kind of strange because it's, you know, it's very explicitly like movie land and this, that, and the other, but it's got a very comic book kind of look.
Yeah. It's a very, what's weird is it's like a very specific genre of movie too. It's like the tokusatsu, like your Godzillas and your, mm-hmm. Your superheroes in bad costumes, you know, all those weird kinds of like Kamen Rider and Ultraman and Super Sentai, like these things all sort of put in there and kind of wrapped up. But then they also found they could have done something like, hey, we're going to make this look like one of those games. But then you would have been dealing with the limitations of that generation of hardware trying to do human bodies. And that was always kind of crappy. So they basically applied a related medium, comic books, that has a lot of audience crossover, obviously, from, you know, those kinds of shows, and like those kaiju shows with comics, and they sort of blend nicely together. And of course, a lot of those tokusatsus have comic book series attached to them, so it actually just ended up working really nicely.
But am I the only one who wasn't really that impressed by the graphics? I mean, the style, it's such a busy game, but also I remember the graphics being kind of controversial. Like I was living in a dorm room when this game came out, and I showed this to this PlayStation 2 owning friend, and he was like, wow, that kind of looks like crap. You know, he was used to Dark Cloud 2 or whatever, and you know, the way like Beautiful Joe has these big bold lines around the characters, right? And it's not exactly the same type of art style that you would find in Wind Waker. Like
it's gritty by design.
Self-shading is a technique. It's not an art style.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But like the choice of having the traces, the lines around the characters was kind of controversial.
But I always really liked the graphics, and I have to say I kind of enjoyed them even more this time because when I played it back on my GameCube back then, it just was an SVDO hookup, which is not the worst. You know, composite is pretty much the worst. I suppose RF is the worst, but you know what I mean. Now, you know, I did get GameCube component cables right at the end of that cycle, before I even had a TV with a component input, which proved to be a decent investment because they're ridiculously expensive in the years hence for some reason. But yeah, so using them now, Beautiful Joe looks great through component in progressive scan.
Yeah, it does. So, yeah,
the colors really pop, and you know, I like the high contrast look, and I think it looks great. I always thought it looked great, but yeah, I guess, you know, it's not like it wasn't gonna wow you. You know, if you was looking for the whole thing of like, oh, this is gonna wow you with how technically impressive it is, it wasn't going to do much for you, you know. But just in terms of how it looked in general, you know, I really liked it, and I think in that way it's aged a lot better than many of its contemporaries.
Yeah, maybe some of the reaction to Beautiful Joe at the time can be explained by the console wars and the fact that the GameCube always seemed to have something to prove, you know, to I don't know to who, but like it always seemed to be, because when it was unveiled, the GameCube seemed to be so much less powerful on paper. And even if it launched with like the stellar looking Star Wars game, the perception that it was underpowered never really went away.
Yeah, even though, of course, you know, especially because these games were created with the GameCube in mind, the PS2 versions that things like this and Resident Evil would go on to get were not as good.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, Resident Evil 4 would be missing like certain monsters, or you wouldn't fight. You would be fighting one monster instead of two. And Beautiful Joe on the PlayStation doesn't have progressive scan.
I mean, I think even Killer 7 on the PlayStation had issues.
Right.
Like, which you think about that game, like what would define visual issues in that disaster of a game? It's like, how would you tell this looks worse? I don't know. Right. But yeah, I mean,
but those were ports. I mean,
they started life on the GameCube. Yeah. That's the thing.
So I don't know. Like I think there was this feeling that whatever the games looked like on the GameCube, it was never really enough, like to win points in the console war.
This was in your IGN boards phase, right?
Yeah.
Oh, see, you know a hell of a lot more about that shit than I ever did.
So, speaking of our first experiences, so obviously Greg and I both played it. Guillaume, you played it. John, mm-hmm. What about you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure I bought it at launch. I can't even remember,
to
be honest with
you. I don't know about you, John, but it got fantastic reviews.
At the time, it was really years. Yeah. I mean, it was wildly unique at the time. I mean,
Capcom made sure it wouldn't be by the end of the decade.
Yeah. Now, the one good thing is this actually got me to pull out the old GameCube and hook it all up, so I might have to revisit some of my GameCube library. But I bought it at launch. I mean,
any of those still sealed?
No, it's not sealed. No, actually, no. This is back when I actually played games, Greg.
of course, it's that long ago.
I didn't play all the way through it. I think I probably bought another game and ditched it.
Sure this will get discussed, but it is hard. If you're playing it on adults the first time through, especially when, you know, similar to some other Platinum, you know, Clover games as time would go on, like, it doesn't try to overburden explaining stuff to you. And it doesn't necessarily give you that much guidance about what is going to be the best to buy from the shop.
Yeah. Things are going to be used. Right. It tells you how to do something, but not the context in which you may have to use it.
This was a very marked difference playing it again. Obviously, because I had admittedly not that great memories of the game. I was shocked at how much I forgot. Considering this is an old game at this point, right?
And getting I basically forgot everything that came after Fire Leo.
So did I. with that? But the other thing, I suppose, is just that, you know, because it's old, but it's not really old. You know, I've played games a hell of a lot older. I've gone longer periods without replaying games and felt like I had better retention. But anyway, not only did I have what memories I did have of the game to help inform my choices this time and inform my playing through, but also I'd have it, like I said, the template is so similar to stuff like Wonderful 101 Bayonetta.
Except it's 2D, obviously.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of things like upgrading your character and stuff, Bayonetta, it's Halos, you know, in this, it's the Beautifuls or whatever, but it's the same type of thing. It's, you know, buying health expansions, buying magic expansions, buying weapons that could help you through, you know, items
combos
that could help you through, different moves, all that kind of. So I was a lot more wise to, like, okay, what am I going to get the most out of early? Like, the first time I played it, I don't think I bought the VFX recharger thing quite late on because it's expensive. It's like, that's like an exotic thing that you get. No,
that's
get
the
it
first
early.
Thing I bought.
Get it damn early, because just saving that time where you kind of end up in regular Joe form, you really don't want that to last long, because you will, you know, die if you stay in that for you, because you can't do a lot and you will take more damage. So
yep.
the big thing about that VFX recharge is just being able to minimize the amount of time you're stuck in that form and do more while you've got the meter rolling and all that. That's a big deal. And this time, you know, I just went straight after it, and you know, the experience was a lot smoother. But especially back then, when, you know, I had none of this kind of context for it, fumbling my way through the game and all that, it was tough. I mean, there were multiple sort of point junctures in the game where I took breaks from it because I wasn't making a lot of headway. And yeah, Fire Leo was one of those. Well, that whole thing, you know, the whole story.
So yeah. Looking at our thread for this, and we'll touch on some of the posts that come up later, but I'm kind of taken aback by, we're going with Zeke's as the pronunciation for his account, who is, you know, very into this game, very into the Kamiya back catalog from the sound of it.
Yeah, very much into Bayonetta, and I've seen him play through Bayonetta 2 on Miiverse, and he was posting all the you know, platinum trophies that he was getting.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So I'm just sort of like kind of at a loss reading it, because so playing it this time when I went back through, I beat the game on normal way back when. It didn't unlock the special stuff, which requires you play the game really well, because I was never really able to get, you know, I was always kind of in the A, B ranking range. Occasionally I'd break into a V. But all these little tips that he throws out in the thread for just for dealing with stuff really kind of makes me think back to just like, oh, wow, I could have done this a lot better. And I started reading his stuff yesterday, like really getting in there and really trying to apply it. And so when I started this playthrough, I went into the regular mode, did not go into easy, got to the third stage, and then just got stymied. And I was like, well, I've got to get through this game. So I flipped it to easy and just burned through it. Really the only time I was running into problems were the puzzles, which which I was struggling with a little bit, because some of them aren't super clear.
Yeah. Not always that intuitive either. I mean, they kind of have their own in-game logic. Like the whole thing with slowing down the little rocket engines on that one, that bit on that van or whatever.
Yeah,
earlier.
The bus. Yeah, that one. Slow, I was like, down, I had to go to an FAQ for that. I was like, I can't figure this out. This is
there's kind of a logic to it in the game. I mean, in the game generally, like if you slow fire down, it expands and gets more powerful, and it can hurt you.
That's such a stretch, though. It's like,
fire up, it puts it out. So like that's the game logic, but especially because it's early on and it hasn't really established that, it's not intuitive at all.
Hadn't you thrown a bomb inside a tunnel and like the kind of
you've
makes
done
the
stuff
lava go up, right?
Yeah, you've done stuff with it. It's not totally out of the blue, but I don't think it's like, maybe if it had been later on, I would have felt like it was, you know, fit into the pattern more obviously. At that stage, I think it's still kind of like, you know, does this have a, you know, another rule to it? Or, you know, I think that's a bit where a lot of people might not have got it straight away.
Yeah, for me, it was
gone to the internet for it.
For me, it was the submarine stage where it just seemed like there were these puzzles that. So that stage, you're in a submarine that's sinking because Joe can't not fuck up everything, essentially. And you flip it over twice and the stage essentially just reverses. And you have all these puzzles where, like, you've got to run over these missiles. But like you have to realize, oh, there's some floor here I can break. But at the same time, missiles are flying at your head. And you have to drag one of those propeller platforms around and stuff. I cleared that stage the other day, just miserable. Only to see that Freestar posted in the forums that, in fact, most of that stage can be skipped at the beginning with the torpedoes. If you go on the right where you're supposed to go, you can find the torpedoes are being fired, go through that area, and you'll end up right at the boss. I didn't know this
I'd already beaten that level on my playthrough this time before I read that, but yeah, it's interesting
because that level is a pain. And
assume, like, you know, at the same time you would skip earning a lot of beautifuls
you would
and stuff,
but you
if
could
you do that.
Yeah, and that's the trade-off, I guess. But at this point, like, I was playing it on easy, so I wasn't buying any hearts. I didn't need them. So I was really just buying the 20,000 and 30,000 beautiful, you know, power ups.
Yeah, right. And the, like the better max speed and the yeah the VFX and all those.
Yes, things. One of the ones I'm curious about, and I see some people talking about it, some people liking it and don't. Beautiful Forever. That's the one I think where you dodge and slow, and then you zoom
in, and it's mm-hmm. it sort of activates an attack.
Yeah.
Type of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, the whole screen gets hit with it gets some damage.
So I just flipped to that today because I was trying to run through the last couple stages, and I don't think I ever bought it because it always seemed hard to pull off. Like, okay, I have to dodge while slowed down and then hit the stick. What I didn't
Well, realize. No, it, like I said, but it's when it says dodge, it's not actually...
It's not actually a dodge.
It's not you physically dodging. It's basically whenever Joe gets hit in slow...
Right.
It depends what's hitting you. But if you're using the slow power, then, you know, then rather than just taking damage immediately, it kind of will take a certain amount of the magic meter away, which might just mm-hmm. force you out of, beautiful Joe mode altogether. Right. But if it doesn't, then you've kind of got a choice. You just let the magic kind of take that hit and then, but then like resume slow after that. Or if you zoom in, it'll activate the Beautiful Forever if right. you bought it. At which point,
a nice AOR.
It will force you out of Joe mode. Out of Beautiful Joe mode at that point. You'll be temporarily invincible afterwards as well.
Yeah, so, and because every enemy gets hit, usually they all get knocked back as well. So right. it gives you some time to recover your VFX meter.
Yeah, when combined with the VFX charger, I found today that was a really good combo. There's an enemy that starts showing up late in the game that's these big yellow burly things.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, like, I couldn't figure out how the hell to kill them. Like I can pound on them for a while and eventually they go down. And what I determined is when you get behind them, you do a lot more damage.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you wait for them to do, like, either throw in, like, the one sort of punch or they do that crazy screw attack thing.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. yeah, get on the wrong side. What I always like, it's not, I don't think it's strictly the best way to do it, but if you zoom in and do the uppercut, a slow zoom in uppercut, so he just keeps doing it over and over, just punching right into the lower back until they shatter. I love kick, because they, when I played it the first time, I didn't really know, I was the same as you. I was like, these things take forever to kill, they're terrible. And then this time, you might sort of better knowledge of the game and all that. I was like, yes, I remember these dickheads, they're going down straight away.
So that's something that we mentioned earlier, that the game is not really overly concerned with telling you how to play it, and
or even giving you any hint at the weakness of things.
And so approaching each enemy can be radically different if you do know what you're doing or if you don't. I remember when I first got the game, I was stuck at the first quote-unquote boss. It was not even a boss, it was the helicopter. And I remember just trying to tackle it head-on, again and again and again, and just kind of grinding V's that way and improving the character until, you know, I could actually beat it. And that was not the way to do it, right? Like, you can try, because it kind of seems like it kind of works. You know, you can kind of jump on the front of the helicopter and stand there a little bit and throw a few punches, but eventually you kind of you lose your footing and the blades touch you, but if you're in slow-mo, you're going to dodge them, or Joe is going to dodge them. And it's just, it's very time-consuming. And then you realize, oh, wait, the whole game, the whole point here is to punch back the bullets or the enemies that spring out of it into the helicopter, and that deals an incredible amount of damage. And that's how you're supposed to face it.
And it also slows down the blade, so you can then use slow to bring it down to the ground and then pound on it a little bit for extras. And, you can kill it in short order.
Well, and they build on that because later you fight, I guess it's a Harrier or Harrier-like, and it shoots missiles, a lot of them. And if you hit those back and you slow down time, it does the giant explosion, which does a tremendous amount of damage.
Mm-hmm.
I managed to knock back an entire volley of its missiles and almost killed it. Like, at the very beginning of the fight.
Right.
And then I basically just ignored the enemies it was throwing out and was just doing jump, zoomed, like, spinning kicks. Yeah. And I just chained them, and it just bounced.
I love the spinning kick in Zoom is great when sped up. It's not so much that it's that useful, but it's just hilarious to watch. It's so fun. this corkscrew. Just it's brilliant.
Yeah, so the whole, like, the game doesn't really tell you that. You have to figure it out. You have to figure out that the boss, the first bat, whatever he's called, like Dark Fiend something, he'll have several attacks. Several of them are really annoying. He'll shoot these kind of boomerangs at you. Very obnoxious, but eventually hits the ceiling, the stalactites fall down, and then you punch them into the enemy, and that deals an incredible amount of damage. And it stuns him, so you can keep dealing even more damage. And so, yeah, like, the game kind of tells, it kind of shows you at the beginning, when you first get the slow power, that you want to dizzy these enemies and punch them, and then what's not clear is that you want to send them into each other to kind of get a multiplier going, and you want to be kind of stringing these attacks together. Like, if you dizzy and slow punch an enemy, then all of the other ones become much more vulnerable. And so it's kind of a race to punch each and every enemy on the screen while you still have some VFX juice going.
Yeah, so you're doing stuff like trying to, you know, just maybe finally, like, do the red hot kick, like, get on the floor and slide over somewhere else, tap that guy, tip the next. It's a little sort of puzzle unto itself, like, what's the easiest way? Because, you know, you can uppercut them straight in the air, you can kick them sort of diagonally in the air, you can punch them straight over there. You know, what's going to be the easiest way for me to get, like, contact four guys while in one run of slow-mo, and then that multiplies the beautifuls you earn. And that's the thing. I mean, another thing, apart from me just buying the VFX charger sooner, I think the fact that I had a better grasp of that meant I was earning beautifuls a lot quicker, so I was just buying everything sooner than I did the first time, you know. So it was just, that's the thing. I never replayed this game straight after beating it the first time. It was a hard old slog to beat it, and I just got, it's not like I ever said, oh, I'm never touching that again. It was just like,
it's just like, enough for now kind of thing.
Yeah, enough for now. And then, you know, I hadn't really got back to it in any major way until now, all these years later. But it, you know, clearly, you know, having played Bayonetta, Wonderful 101, all these, you know, it was clearly meant to be replayed, you know, and, I guess that's the thing. I never really got that joy out of it. Like, okay, cause I mean, especially, you know, if you just played it with Joe again, rather than one of the other characters, you could keep everything. You know, you could go up a difficulty level, but have all your health and all your moves and all that to kind of compensate a bit. You know, and that's something I really enjoyed doing with Wonderful 101 or Bayonetta, but I never did that because I didn't really get it. You know, I guess that's
it was kind of new.
It's a weird kind of mix, you know. It's very arcadey in some ways, especially because of the way you've got the lives and stuff. But, you know, you've, like, the fact that it doesn't even save when you get to a boss, you know? So, like, you've got a checkpoint there. So if you keep fighting, you know, you'll keep just going up against the boss no matter how many lives you lose. But say, for instance, if you wanted to walk away, then you come back and you've got to go do the whole sort of half of the level leading up to the boss again, which is something that they would not reprise for things like Bayonetta and, you know, 1-4-101. That kind of always felt a bit at odds, like they hadn't quite got that mapped out yet, but that's it. I didn't really kind of understand the exact kind of experience they were going for back then.
Yeah. Like it's funny because I did end up replaying the game soon afterwards, and I managed to get it. But yeah, like the first time that I played through, it was an adult difficulty, and I think I pretty much brute forced my way through the game. You know, like this thing with the facing the helicopter head on. I did that for the whole game.
that's the thing, because that's the first example. But there's so many more. Like, I don't think I twigged until really late the whole thing about when you are zoomed in, you could just hold down the button to do that kind of slapping thing, which is devastating on the button. Like, definitely does way more damage on bosses and things. Like when you've got a certain window to attack them in. So I get all these kinds of things that I guess.
Yeah,
it's nice in a way, though. I like the fact that it is, but it
demands a lot of people. Like, I think the game had maybe a little bit too much faith in the player because eventually, like, when I started a new game, I did it on the V-rated difficulty that you unlock, and from at that point, the enemies block you a lot more. And so you're not actually doing the dodging thing and attacking them, like weakening them and stuff like that, then you're not getting anywhere. And it's only on that second playthrough, on a harder difficulty, after I had played through the whole game, that it clicked and that I understood. And all of a sudden I went from like, yeah, I guess Beautiful Joe's all right to, oh, this is this is really fun, you know? But I had to play through the whole game. And so... yeah, I think that perhaps a little bit more could have been done to, you know, coddle players a little bit
more. Yeah, I mean, when I picked it back up again, I mean, I really, there was an adjustment period. At first, I was getting just my ass kicked all over the place. But once I actually started to get used to the fact that, you know, I really got in the habit of, I almost felt like with RPGs where you're like, you know, you do something, you save, you do something, you save, and you kind of get into that sort of safety mechanism. I was doing that, like every single enemy I would come across, I would immediately just run the entire, you know, gamut on them. I would slow down and see how they do. Then I would speed it up and see how they do. Then I would, like, you know, try all of the other VFX stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's like I just habitually started trying everything, just throwing everything, including the kitchen sink at enemies, especially new ones.
It's something that would come back a lot with Wonderful 101. That's a common thing that people would say about that game, you know, that it didn't really explain itself that much, or, you know, it really kind of felt like they ended up making a game kind of similar to this years later, even though, you know, that's like a top down thing that some people might think looks like Pikmin or whatever. Like, you know, you hear a lot of the same kind of feedback, and, you know, that I don't think that necessarily clicked with me altogether until I was playing it like the second time round. But I kind of got a glimpse of what might have been with Beautiful Joe if I'd sort of gone for a second playthrough with that when I did. I bought that a month or two after it came out.
So, actually, John, you had picked out a quote I think I kind of like here. You'd kind of pulled out a little bit of a dissenting opinion. We talked about the game being kind of busy visually and kind of actiony and over the top ridiculous. And and it seems like, and Greg spoke to this now a little bit, like there's, and Guillaume, there's this sense of like when you first play this game, it's just kind of daunting.
Yeah.
And frustrating. And it's really that second and third and fourth pass where you start to bring the game to, you know, you get control over it and it starts to make sense. And I talked about it a little bit with Mega Man Zero where you've got this sense of just like, I need to get good at this right now and then I'll be able to enjoy it. But you pulled out something where somebody talked about how the difficulty of doing that. You could go ahead and read it for me, please.
Yeah, E-Jammer, he said, tried playing again last night. And this is actually a follow-up to his original post where he said something very similar to this. Tried playing again last night. I still think this is the kind of game I'd rather watch someone else, i.e. someone good, play than play myself. My kids watched a little bit and commented, I don't know what's going on. This game is too crazy. I felt about the same way. I still love the ideas on display, though. It's a very cool game, but it really does feel like spending enough time to get good would make it an awesome experience. And he's absolutely right. If you immediately get turned off by the learning curve, see, that's the problem. They give you pretty much all the tools that you need to succeed right up front, but they really don't tell you how you should optimally use them. But once you figure that out, like Guillaume just said, you're like, the light bulb goes on. You're like, oh man, okay. Mm-hmm. And now you want to go through and try everything all over again because you look at the game in a totally different way.
Yeah, I kind of feel that the upgrade part of the game gets in the way of teaching people how to play, because if you want to brute force your way through the game, you can. Like, if you want to grind, like, it's possible. You can hit your head against a wall over and over again.
All
but
those failed attempts would still yield more, you know, beautifuls, and you could keep paying to expand your health bar and whatnot, you know. So, yeah, they, I mean, it wouldn't be absolutely for naught like it would be in a more traditional arcade style experience.
Right. And if you can make it to the train level, then like that's kind of where the game eases up a little bit. Like that level is a bastard of a level.
Oh, it was a lot.
It's timed, and you have to make it through really, really fast.
Well,
but
keep
the
in
first,
mind, the, oh, you're gonna talk about the first half of that level?
No, but I just mean like as you try over and over to beat that level, the first time you go through it, fine. Like you get all these power ups to upgrade your VFX bar, but the second time. A lot of the boxes that yielded these upgrades for the VFX bar give you this, you know, these bottles of unlimited beautiful VFX juice, basically. So from that point on, yeah, so you can basically just hold down the slow button and just keep wailing at enemies and just keep making the multiplier go up and up and up, and at that point in the game, it's kind of easy, quote unquote, to rack up like 9,099, you know, beautifuls all in one shot, and so at that point, you kind of almost don't have to learn the game anymore. Like that's probably the point where you're gonna have upgraded Joe completely. It's just like it's just this weird thing where the upgrade element again like kind of gets in the way of you even trying to learn how to play the game.
Yeah, but
it's interesting. I said because that is mostly something they've carried on, you know, through today. You know, like say, yeah. Some of these things came up again with Wonderful 101. Your Bayonetta's got a shop and all that. One thing that changed was what you talked about with actually expanding the VFX meter. You know, the fact that you have to collect those, you know, the things that are strewn across the level.
Yeah.
You know, in each, you know, your VFX meter goes back down to that nub. Every time you start a new level. And so you kind of have this cycle of like, okay, well, whereas before I could kind of chain together these things for ages, you know, the back end of the last level, now I'm kind of going back down again. Which is, I don't know. I'm not sure. That's something that, you know, that doesn't happen in Bayonetta. You know, you don't, your magic meter is permanently expanded. And same for Wonderful 101. So they clearly thought better of that for whatever reason. That sort of having this cycle within each level where, well, okay, you're gradually getting more powered up by all these things you buy, but we're kind of going to depower you. And then there's a somewhat of an incentive to explore around a little bit for like extra stuff, you know, kind of, I guess, you know, how thorough you are is going to determine how long your VFX meter is once you get to the boss, which certainly, you know, can make it significantly easier if you've got like a really long one. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting idea, but I'm not sure, you know.
So
I guess just the fact that exploration's not that important to the game, you know, like when you compare it to some of the stuff that's hidden away in Bayonetta and Wonderful 101, you know, these sort of additional challenges that you warp off to where you'll find, you know, magic segments or heart segments, you know, that are completely hidden. They're not just ones that you buy. You know, things like that. It feels like that's a greater part of those games. Partially just because of, you know, the perspective and things. It's more difficult to hide stuff. You know, with the side scrolling type of thing. A lot of the time you're talking about using the max speed to like punch stuff in the background, you know, things like that to get.
And even then, you can't really do it unless you have the max speed upgraded.
And there are enemies to hit.
And there
you've got to use them, you know, while they're around, possibly.
Yeah, although the game does its best to have the camera not show you what you need to see when you're trying to explore.
Yeah, there's some bad camera work going on.
Yeah,
in this
there
game.
Is. Like that's why, like, especially when you're doing anything up in the air, it's so annoying. You're,
the
like,
tilt up.
Yeah, that upwards tilt of the camera that just obscures what you're trying to come down on top of. It's so annoying.
Yeah, and sometimes you'll have like some of these VFX gauge extending thingies.
Yeah,
we got to find out V-film anyway.
V-films.
So yeah, sometimes they'll be hidden like down from you.
Yes,
like on the level where you fight the Dark Fiend again, the bat guy. There's some that are hidden down there, you know, and you have to fall down a hole where there's also like poison that hurts you.
Yeah.
So you have to, there's lots of leaps of faith to be made in the game. And it's just, that's not the game's strength at all.
No, I would imagine. So, well, I'd imagine if they made the game now, obviously it wouldn't necessarily have all this leaps of faith stuff, but a lot of what I ended up having to do was sort of learning to master the double jump. and I would do like a probatory jump out and then come back in. But I was actually having a lot of problems with this game, and what I found out was that with the wave bird, it for whatever reason would lose the signal at like a microsecond level and think I had released the shoulder buttons, so it would essentially just restart. And I was having an unbelievable amount of trouble with the stupid slot machines.
But, oh, right, yeah.
Because it would release like right before I was getting ready to press the button. And it would let it go and I'd miss. So I ended up having to pull out a wired controller, which took a lot of doing, because that meant I had to A, dig it out, and then B, stand there in front of the TV like an idiot and play the game. But,
Well, while we're on this subject, though, the Smash Brothers kind of re-release of the GameCube controller has a much longer cord.
Yes, it
and
does.
They're very high quality controllers, so I would stock up on those for anyone interested.
Yeah, it's like there's definitely something about this game that demands you really nail these like the inputs, the timing, understanding how they work, like knowing how to go from the red hot kick down into like a slide and like basically forming a Z, like jump kick across, red hot kick down, and then slide back across. Things like that where you're kind of managing enemy mobs or going into that spinning kick. Like all of that stuff really comes back.
Yeah, it has kind of a Smash Brothers feel at times.
To an extent, but really it goes back
especially,
to like...
Especially if you're playing with Bayonetta in Smash, because, I mean, Beautiful Joe could be like a future alternate for Bayonetta in Smash. You know, the kind of moves she's doing, corkscrewing into the air, doing the kicks in the air. I mean, like, if you add the down input to her side B in the air, then that is like a red hot kick type of thing. Like, they could totally do it one day if they wanted to.
What gets me, though, is how... I mean, this is obviously very early character action, as we define the term now. Like, we've really, because DMC had come out, but it was pre like DMC4, where that series really.
Also, I guess the biggest, from what I might understand, I guess the biggest thing that this introduced was the way that the actual battles were kind of compartmentalized. So it could grade you in terms of how quickly you beat them, without punishing you for like actually trying to do some of these things we're talking about, exploring for the V film and all that kind of stuff, because the encounters are like their own little pocket thing, you know, within the level. So
yeah, you're only timed from the time that that girl says go for it,
just go for it, yeah.
And then you get a grade at the end, and then you're free to explore and find a V film.
And again, that's something that they've, you know, kept that formula going ever since. Mm-hmm. And it is a cool way of sort of threading that needle of, you know, wanting to have this graded system that's very important, you know, suggested to you. I guess it's part of their way of suggesting to you, like, yes, you might have done this bit, but you could have done it a lot better. And I probably should have heeded that a lot more the first time I played it, you know, because it's like, yeah, I'm not doing this optimally at all, am I? But like, brute force in it, as Guillaume said.
Yeah, but the second time through, when you keep your power ups, it actually becomes much easier to get
much easier rainbow
V's, because not only you have the slow power up from the beginning, you have the zoom power up from the beginning, so you dispatch these early enemies really quickly. Like, you wonder why the hell you ever struggled in that game when you play through once again with a fully powered character.
Absolutely. And,
so yeah, like I don't think that you're meant to get rainbow V's the first time, although I'm sure that
the rainbow V's maybe not, but like I remember when I was playing it, you know, back in 2003, like, you know, I was just getting terrible grades all around, and I obviously every now and again there'd be the odd thing that I could do well, but I just didn't quite really get that what they were going for, because it was just kind of I was trying to play it more like, you know, an arcade game than it was, you know, because that's just what it seemed like to me at that point. But now, like I say, you know, really get what they're driving at.
Yeah, they called it a brawler when it came out, and it just conjures up, you know, pictures of Streets of Rage or Final Fight, but it's really, it doesn't have that much in common with the games from that lineage. Like, it doesn't have Yeah, like as you say, like the compartmentalized battles and like the character action stuff.
There's nothing else in a brawler. I mean, you know, you can't compartmentalize the combat bits.
Right.
No, you can't.
That's the whole game. You know, no, exactly. It's quite a lot more to it than that would have suggested. You know, you think Capcom, mm-hmm. you might think Final Fight, and it's just no. It's a lot more than that. And I didn't really quite fully appreciate that until I'd kind of finished the game really the first time. But you know, it just. I feel like, you know, the bosses as well, and it were a really kind of key part where, you know, they showed you a little bit more of, you know, what you needed to be playing, like, in a more optimal way. Because some of them could take forever if you weren't doing it very, you know, you just have to, like, you'd have to play badly really well, if you know what I mean. Like, you'd have to have a terrible strategy, but then execute it extraordinarily well to sort of manage to brute force that. Yeah. Whereas, you know, there were other ways of doing it. I think we got a quote about this to do with the shark boss, haven't we?
Somewhere. Oh, yes. John, you want to read it?
Sure, man.
Thank you, sir.
All right. This is Top by Top Hat Ant 123 or Tuffatant 123, depending
yep,
on
Tuffatant.
How you want to. The shark boss can two-shot you if you didn't realize you can wiggle the stick to get out, but there is no actual feedback to tell you this is working, so I found out that this. So I found this the most frustrating part so far. I feel like for this game in particular, knowledge is power, and no amount of button mashing or spamming would allow you to coast through without properly learning. I like the Leo the Lion boss, since it uses the mechanics of the game in new ways instead of introducing whole new ones, and it requires thinking about exploiting weaknesses for massive damage more than it does reflexes or dexterity.
Yep. Like, there's a couple bosses where it's really just about understanding their scheme and knowing how best to counter it with the moveset you have. I would say that, I'm trying to remember what his name is, the Sentai character wearing all black with horns.
Alistair.
Yeah, like, he's not hard as long as you understand the vulnerabilities of his attacks. And he's got, I mean, much like boss fights from, you know, time immemorial, he has patterns and there are ways to respond to his patterns. But like the swords, for example, he swings swords at you. But he's also blasting lightning around the stage. So you need to understand his lightning generators are always going to be low enough you can bound over them. So don't just try to move with them.
And you can punch them to stop them.
Right. But the swords, if you hit them using like the spin kick and then slow them down as they hit him, it does more damage to him. So you can stack the swords by using the spin kick in the right way. Like, there's all kinds of like little like, you just need to execute this strategy knowing that this is what he's exposing, so this is how you have to do it. If you just try to catch him on foot and just run him down, good luck. Good fucking luck, because you're going to get messed
now,
up.
And that's the thing, really. I mean, a lot of these, you know, again, like, very different from your typical kind of brawler or whatever, which it might superficially seem like, you know, just kind of getting in there and wailing on them. It just, a lot of the time, it doesn't really work. I mean, you know, or it's certainly nowhere near the most, even though it might seem like, you know, kind of what you were saying about Mega Man Zero, like, you know, if you take the attitude, like, I just want to kind of blaze through and mess these things up, like, it just isn't going to do it. You know, it's not right. That kind of game. It ends up being a hell of a lot more slow paced as a result, you know, especially because literally the slow power is a lot of the time how you're going to do the most damage, particularly in conjunction with zooming in. It ends up having quite a slow pace, even compared to some of the stuff they've done since, like Bayonetta. You know, I mean, with Bayonetta, you've got Witch Time where you slow the enemy down, but you still, you know, attack really fast and stuff. And obviously, Bayonetta has got, you know, very nuanced combat and all that, but I think you can get to top at a to Top Hat's point, I think you can get further with kind of button mashing and spamming in those games, at least on the sort of,
right,
you know, the equivalent of the adult's difficulty in those.
Because Bayo has deeper combo systems. Like,
yeah. You know, I think in terms of, yeah, if you're going to get, like, you know, in that game, you're talking about platinum trophies instead or pure platinums instead of the Rainbow Beautifuls or whatever, you know, you're going to have to learn, you're gonna have to get better, you have to really understand what you're doing, and but in terms of with Beautiful Joe, you just getting through the game the first time on adults is, you know, more you're going to have to learn and do some of these stuff. There isn't so much kind of button mash that you can do. So I think it's an important point. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the whole thing of getting better at the game and all that, I mean, I think in some ways it's better now. You have YouTube and easily shared videos and stuff, you know. I mean, not that the internet didn't exist all those years ago, but you couldn't easily see someone doing a playthrough where they just completely kick ass and stuff. And, you know, I'm not saying you're just going to watch that and grasp everything that they're doing, but you're going to be, you know, you could get, you know, tips, you know, you could absorb a certain amount of thing, you know, it's going to give you ideas and stuff. I mean, there's a tiny little shred of that in the attract mode, I guess, with this.
Right.
You know, which, funnily enough, looks god awful. Because it's actual video. Badly compressed video on a GameCube disc where the colors are all washed out and it looks good. It's like an attract mode that looks way worse than the actual game. It's like defeating its entire purpose virtually. But it does have, it does show you a, like some very basic stuff. But yeah, it's never going to give you the kind of full view that maybe these days, you know, people will be like, you know, sharing around everywhere. Like, and of course, you know, people play old games and put that on YouTube, so it's there. But, you know, it's kind of, I really feel like it'd be nice if they went back to this kind of game, because I know Bayonetta, Wonderful 101, all these other things that sprung up, the Transformers, Turtles, Revengeance, you know, I mean, they do all sorts of third-person action games that follow this template. But actually, another side-scrolling type of one is not something they've really gone back to.
No, not after two. Oh, well, They didn't make the DS game, did they?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that one. But even that is a long time ago now.
It is. It was near launch on the DS.
They've kind of had rumblings about doing like a Bayonetta spin-off on 3DS with Jean instead. And, you know, maybe that could be something like that. They've had little teases. But I really think, you know, with the refinements they've made to the general formula, taking it back and putting it into a 2D type of game like this again, maybe something that's a bit faster paced, I think would be I really like what they do with Beautiful Joe, but even, you know, when I'm more proficient at the game, the pace still kind of is one reason why I'm not as keen to replay it as I have some of the other Platinum's other games. It isn't quite, you know, the most replayable games to me. You know, we talk about Zero Mission, something like that. You know, so it's something that just has that link between worlds, for instance, that has that kind of just that buttery smooth play experience is always the most inviting for replay. And Bayonetta has some of that, this less so, but it's still well worth replaying. I might do it eventually.
So does anybody have any kind of closing thoughts as we wrap up discussion about this game and want to move on towards a little bit about what came later?
Sure. Well, did I mention that I used to love this game? It was one of my favorite GameCube games, and I was looking. I still had I still had my save from back in the day, and I had pretty much unlocked everything. So I had beaten the game on the hardest difficulty. I think it's called Ultra V-rated, and I had unlocked all the characters. And looking at my different save files, it's basically, it looks like I never really enjoyed playing as anyone other than Joe. I think I might have beaten the game as Sylvia.
Well, there is an issue with that, isn't there? Because I unlocked Sylvia with this playthrough. But the problem is, if you want to play as Sylvia, you've got to go back to Ground Zero. You know, no expanded, you've got to, no expanded health bar, no expanded moves and all that. You know, you'd have to sort of go backwards to play as her. And that actually, I think, is still a problem in the original Bayonetta. Like, if you unlock Jean, you have the same thing.
Oh, yeah, you start from zero.
But in Bayonetta 2, they fixed it. You could play as Jean, but with all the extra powers and your health and whatever that you'd earned.
You don't have to unlock the diving kick again.
Yeah, exactly. That just feels like such a crazy step backwards at that point. And yeah, I'm kind of amazed that that was still a problem in even the first Bayonetta.
Right. So, but that's Sylvia. I mean, like, her character takes more damage, is faster,
She's so fast! I would love to play more of
her. But the fact that at least her powers work the same way as Joe's. Then you've got Alistair, and he's, you know, like we were talking about basically playing a, you know, finger twister, like how complicated it becomes, like slowing down and zooming in and kicking and zooming out. And
I never
so
got,
that's pretty complicated.
I never got good at is the Ukemi thing. You know, where you zoom in to prevent damage. Like, yes. It's not that hard to grasp. You hit the zoom in before you hit the floor, basically.
Right.
I never got good at that.
Yeah, well, you need to slow down time, really. And you need to zoom in before you actually hit it, like a little bit before. But, with Alistair, like, his freaking power is not on ever, except, like, you have to turn it on manually by pressing the Z trigger. And it's just, it's actively annoying, you know, because if you think, because normally when you play as Joe, okay, like I'm dodging this, I just need to slow down time. You press the left shoulder button and it slows down time. But with Alistair, you need to press this Z trigger first and then press the
you do have to beat it on what V-rated to unlock him. So I guess it's like this is the expert character, but it's not very
inviting. It's not fun. And then you've got
a
reward.
But then you also unlock Blue, and he's a little bit less annoying in that his powers work the same way as Joe, but he doesn't have the double jump. Instead, when he's unpowered, it can only jump once, and when he's Captain Blue, he jumps twice as high. And he can also, if you press the jump button again and hold it, he can hover sideways like he does when you battle him. But Alistair, like, what a bastard. He's not fun to play at all. And, like, I could see, like, in my save files, like, I'm maybe, like, on level 3 with him. And, yeah, I don't think I've ever finished a game with any other character than Joe. But, you don't really need to. I mean, like, beyond the first cinematic, I think you've pretty much seen, like, all that these characters can offer. Like, when you play as Sylvia, it's so weird because you've got the opening scenes, like they're exactly the same, but the dialogue has been replaced and everyone speaks like backwards for some reason. Like,
I guess because
they jumbled.
Yeah, because they will change the dialogue in terms of like the subtitles, but they wouldn't want to have more voice acting. It wouldn't be worthwhile to pay, you know, to have more voice acting just for these extra unlockable stuff that probably most people won't ever see. So instead of actual voice acting for those bits, it's just other bits of those characters' voices played backwards and jumbled up and stuff to obscure it.
But it's so funny because, like, when you play as Sylvia, then, like, the opening cutscene where normally it would be Sylvia kind of jumping all over Joe trying to, you know, get some attention from him, then it's Sylvia and her sister, and her sister is just like, why didn't you bring me see this crappy movie, and I'm going to tickle you, quote unquote. And it's just it's kind of weird. And then if you play as Alistair instead of Joe, it's Alistair, and Sylvia is really into Bad Boys all of a sudden. And when it's Captain Blue, thankfully Sylvia has been replaced by her mom.
Yes.
And we don't have to see anything too grotesque. But I gotta say, like, over, like, these alternate realities where the game, you know, like, with the different characters, like, Sylvia doesn't come across as, doesn't look very good, I gotta say.
Like, actually, I have a quote about that from the thread from Strawberry Jam. She says, quote, you know, Strawberry Jam talks a lot about their experience with the game, and I'll actually use this quote a little bit later, but it ends this post with, quote, also, he and Sylvia don't have a very effective relationship. They really should not be together.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree. Because for me, after you fight Alistair, the narrator reminds Joe that he's in here trying to rescue Sylvia. And he's like, oh, that's right. I forgot about her. And like, there's like, he made the terrible mistake of forgetting Sylvia. Uh-oh. That's like, yep. Thanks, Joe. You're the best.
Yeah, it's not really a game that you play for its story.
No,
and in fact, it seems like the
it's deliberately stupid.
Yeah, and the developer or whoever is responsible for the dubbing didn't seem to think it was important for us to understand what the bosses.
Yeah, because they've all got some sort of distortion effect on them, and it's unintelligible.
Yeah, and the music is drowning their voices.
Yeah, that,
it's
horrible. The combination of the two things just. I have no idea what the hell it's like. I would say it's funny because it's like when it's one boss, you kind of think, oh, okay, maybe that particular distortion thing was a problem. But it's all of them. Like, it really is.
Yeah, the one where they're screaming I'm trying to think would be a good example to describe it. Like Geddy Lee of Rush. Like he's just screaming at the top of his vocal range. Like that's the only one I can really understand consistently. It's bad. It's a bad scene. But I kind of like when I understand what they're. So actually, to that point, I went looking for a closed captioning. And no, this is pretty closed captioning in all the games.
Yeah, who needs it?
But I like it because I like what they have to say because it's usually dumb and pointless. And now I just hear them mumbling at me. It's like, all right.
Speaking of the sort of laying down the template for future games, when you beat Alistair, there's a pretty gratuitous crotch shot of Joe. So, to be fair, that's paved the way for what they would do with Bayonetta. Perfect. Like.
Anybody else have any closing thoughts on this game in particular?
I feel like it's a game that it could have been a mascot game maybe, but they certainly tried. It was too difficult, too obscure.
They made four of these damn things.
Yeah. Yeah, they certainly tried, but I think also
put out toys and stuff.
Yeah, I think also it makes more sense looking back on it, seeing everything that Platinum has put out since, more so than it did back then.
Oh yeah. That's my takeaway. Like having played a bunch of their stuff now, like it all makes sense.
Yeah,
this game, to Greg's point, I would like to see them do a 2D game just to apply their learnings to this. But this as a project for Capcom, you know, mid-level and higher talent, sort of get their wings going. You know, get some experience. Like it all adds up in a way that when you play it, you see all of this. You're like, this really was a teaching project, and they learned a lot because you see this stuff popping up from here on out. It's, you know, I enjoyed this game when I played it the first time. I enjoyed it this time. I got frustrated as hell with it sometimes. puzzles and stuff were just, they're not well designed, but it kind of makes me wish I had bought Beautiful Joe 2 at the time because it's not the easiest game in the world to get right now. Certainly, it's not as easy as Beautiful Joe. Less copies were made, whatever. It's not impossible. It's just, but I wanted to actually read the rest of the Strawberry Jams post, which is, I have a strange relationship with Beautiful Joe. It was the first game I ever pre-ordered back in 2003 when I was 12. It was all I could do to contain my excitement. It was overwhelming waiting from when I put my money down to May when the game shipped in October. But on that day, the game that came out, my dad died unexpectedly. It was just, but we basically went to pick it up and they played it for the next few weeks. And, you know, that lots of family crises that were popping up, but they talk about how beating the game several times down the branching path, the new game plus, and, you know, learning all these skills, it was sort of the perfect mind numbing brawler to play through while dealing with this kind of tragedy. And it was great. I rarely felt completely duped by puzzles, but perhaps I'm forgetting some. I got the sequel and never finished it. And haven't touched the game since, and supremely interested to know what they think of it 13 years later. It's kind of this, I can see that though, I can see this becoming a game that if you need something to really focus on, like something to just really lock into for whatever reason, you could totally do it for this. Cause we talked about these, there is a learning curve to all of this stuff, and you can polish up the skills on all of the unlockable characters. And you can go and try to get rainbow V's on all the stages. Like there's so much the ability to just dig down into this game and get really good at it. And I could see it being a really cathartic experience for somebody who's dealing with something away from this rainbow pastel crazy town world of literally people in suits in a movie who think they're actually the real thing coming to life and exiting a movie screen. Like, when you really think about what the plot of this game is, that's what it is. It's costume monsters actually being real things escaping the movie.
Yeah, it's the obvious last action hero thing, yeah. But without Charlie Dance.
but with the cartoon characters.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, it's... But you know, I'm glad to hear that. You know, that question actually comes up every so often for the show. Like, what games have you had with difficulty in your life? And I could totally see Beautiful Joe being one of those. So I appreciate Strawberry Jams sharing that story with us. That understandably have been very difficult to deal with. So I'm glad that a game was able to help with that experience. But I wanted to use that to transition to 2, to the DS game, to Red Hot Rumble. Did any of y'all get 2? I know it's come up
a
little
bit. I didn't.
No, it was just so soon after, it just kind of felt like, I'll get around to that. It wasn't like, oh no, I don't want it, or, you know, anything. It was just like, well, yeah, I'd be interested in that. I really enjoyed the first one, but
Not right now.
I'm not in a rush, and then it never happened. You know,
right.
Even though it's like, oh, that late GameCube era was so flush with stuff to play. I really don't know how I didn't get around to it.
I'm just wondering if maybe they didn't make that many, and by the time we all were ready.
Maybe. I mean, because I was still importing at this point, so, you know, like, it wasn't cheap. I mean, it'd come down a lot from the 90s, but it was, you know, it was still expensive, you know, to buy North American GameCube games compared to just buying European ones or whatever, so that probably played some role, but I'd still kind of aghast at how I didn't get around to it.
Yeah.
So even though I really sucked at it, I loved that game. I certainly didn't get, you know, achieve as much as it as Guillaume did, but it was one of my favorite experiences around about that time.
So I got Double Trouble, and I talked about it on the show. It's weird. It's a really strange game, because you think about trying to put a game that sort of prides itself on fast and kinetic on the DS, especially early. And they make a lot of weird compromises, but how it uses the two screens and has, you know, really distinct action on them is kind of cool.
Yeah, but it was more focused on puzzles because they couldn't really put more than two enemies on screen at the time, at the same time.
Yep.
So that really, they had to tone the combat down, but then they had you use the stylus to split the screen, in two, and they tried to create these new Beautiful Joe powers, but apply it to the DS hardware.
You know,
what can we do with a stylus? I guess we can do split screen. And it was this this weird thing where, okay, you trace a horizontal line on the screen, and then you can separate the top and the bottom of the field. And that came to play to solve puzzles a lot.
It was like you were they basically sold it as like you were cutting the frame of the movie.
Right. And so like you had like two mismatched statues, for instance, and so you just like you slide the stylus and you cut the screen in two, and then you slide the top half to connect like the right, I don't know, heads on the right statues and move on. Like, it was clever stuff, but it was, you know, early DS experiments, and we didn't see that kind of experimentation very much towards as the DS became older.
Yeah, I mean, it is very much a product of its era, much like its predecessors. But I think that, to me, that stands out as like, no, Capcom really wanted this to become, you know, one of its pillar franchises. Like, they put out a PSP game, Red Hot Rumble. So Red Hot Rumble was PSP GameCube. There may have been a PS2 version as well.
I think so.
But PSP was definitely lead platform for that thing. Well, PSP and GameCube were. Like, those were the two they were pushing.
Yeah, so I mean, I can tell you why I skipped that game. It's because it came out 3 days after Metroid Prime 2.
Oh.
So that's unfortunate timing on Capcom's part.
There you go. But it is like, it's kind of a bummer that after the two handheld games that they just... So Red Hot Rumble, I think, was kind of a... Like, I played it once in a vague recollection of it. I remember being like, wow, this isn't very good.
So it's a fighting game, right?
It's a Smash knockoff.
Right.
And just remember thinking, like, I don't need this because I've got better Smash and or party games on GameCube already.
Yeah,
so,
it didn't lack for them, did it, GameCube?
What are you doing? Like, I would really like to see Capcom do something with, well, really any of their franchises at this point, to be honest. But this is one that seems ripe for downloadable space. Like, it doesn't have to be a big flat. Like, relive the experience. Simple game engine, simple project, low budget as you can manage. Use it as a teaching experiment. Like, just take it easy. Don't try to blow it out with a big game and just put out a fucking game in one of your franchises, Capcom. Good lord. Anyway, anybody else have any thoughts before we wrap it up about the beautiful franchise or whatever?
No, I mean, I enjoyed playing it through this time. I mean, I think the back end of the game probably, you know, does drop off a little bit until, yeah, you know, I mean, you get the boss rush kind of stage at least. I mean, the fight, Leo fight is really good and really tough. But, you know, having that leading up to it isn't that great. And then the final stage in space, you know, we basically get the Death Star hangar with the Famicom colored Robs in it. Which, according to the forum thread, I think someone said, does make its way into the PS2 game. So, yes, Rob on PS2 confirmed. Nice. But, you know, it looks cool, but there's not a lot going on design-wise in that level. You know, you just got a big corridor, you get three switches, and then you have a number of time challenges, you know, time kill rooms going up vertically, and then you get to the boss fight, you know. So, it doesn't seem like it necessarily had the most amount of care put into the back end of the game. But the one thing I would say is you're kind of learning how to play better first time through, so it kind of mitigates some of the repetition and whatnot. So, you know, I think ultimately it's a really good experience, and I think it's held up really well compared to you know, a number of games that came out in that era, not just visually.
Yeah, I just feel like the game has held up well. I haven't.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm
it seems like you
out.
Were really damn good at that game, so that's
well,
a
eventually yeah. But that's because I was, you know, a student with all the time in the world, and I could practice, and I had more time than games to play, so mm-hmm. I think that today I wouldn't have the patience to learn the game, and that's kind of confirmed by how I'm rubbish at Muramasa right now. So yeah, I think it was great at the time, and I think the game is still really, really good. I'm not sure if I would have given it the chance that I did back then.
It's a young man's game, apparently.
Yeah, but then again, I did cut into Bayonetta 2 more than I expected.
Yeah,
so,
I think you would enjoy this game now. I think based on what you said about other games, I think it hits a lot of the same notes.
I think Bayonetta 2 is the most accessible game I've done, though. More so than the first one, more so than Wonderful 101. Bayonetta 2 is, if you've heard this and you're interested in getting into this whole, you know, that Platinum have had go and in their various guises over the years, I think Bayonetta 2 is probably the best place to get in.
Yeah.
And then you've got the first one, you've got Wonderful 101, you've got this, you can sort of branch out from there.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
I think Joe's good, but not quite good enough to be in Smash Brothers. Sorry, buddy.
He was in Tatsunoko versus Capcom, though, right?
True, he was.
Right.
He was. I think he was also in one of the Marvels as well. But that's going to do it for Retroactive of Beautiful Joe. I want to thank everybody who played along with us and posted their comments in the forum thread. And I want to thank these guys for doing another show with us this week. It's time for plugs. Listener mail. You can send us your emails for listener mail, which we will be back doing next week, to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Again, listener mails to me, kind of lifeblood of the show. Really enjoy that segment more than pretty much anything else in the show. Also, the highest possibility of just driving into the ditch. So send us your emails loaded with opportunities for that to that email address. Also, just as a reminder, Greg did his annual pilgrimage to Radio Trivia about a week ago. Yep. And since this is your second appearance, I believe this is the time where we name one of the games that was in it.
Oh, is it, we will offer one as a teaser.
Yeah.
You know, it's the first game in there. So I spill some Triforce Heroes soundtrack in that as the first game. That has got a sensational soundtrack, whatever else you think about the game and its issues about region lock multiplayer and communication and all sorts of things.
Everything.
The soundtrack is gorgeous, wonderful. I pick out three songs, and then there's more in the background as we discuss the game. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. Worth it for that alone. And then there's four other games.
Yeah, and the reality situation is a lot of people didn't play that game, and this will probably be the opportunity for them to enjoy its music. Which, yeah, you're right, it's really good. And I think that will do it for the show this week. Greg, what is our ending theme?
Well, of course, we had to have something from Beautiful Joe. And again, you know, kind of go along with something that people might not have seen or heard, rather. We've got the music from the very last level of the game. So maybe if you never got past Violia, you didn't hear this. So yeah, it's called Joe and Sylvia.
So we decided not to end on the rap.
Oh, God, the nu metal thing. That dates it so horribly.
Oh, it does.
With the, oh my God. Oh. With the female robot enemy on the decks or whatever. Oh my God. It's like, yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. It did come out then, didn't it?
God.
Definitely not.
And on that nightmare, time to end the show. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Later, bye.
Cut. Cast lane, please. Oh, back up.